Blog Talk Radio.
This particular song right here is dedicated to the black woman, and it doesn't pertain to all black women.
Guest today, we have Dr. Clyde Winters, author, educator, anthropologist, and linguistist, who will be one of our special guests to talk about what best identifies a Black Native American, linguistics, or genetics. Dr. Clyde Winters taught education and linguistics at St. Xavier University in Chicago. Dr. Winters wrote multiple articles on anthropology, archaeogenetics, and linguistics. His articles appeared in the Journal of Black Studies, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. He has done bioessays, and he's written for Current Science and the International Journal of Human Genetics. Dr. Winters' books include African Empires in Ancient America, We're Not Just Africans, The Black Native Americans, Atlantis in Mexico, The Mandate Discovery of America, and Ancient Scripts in South America. Also, we have another special guest, Brother Sifiwe Baleka, a Yale-educated trucker, fitness professional, and professional swimmer. He will be one of our special guests as well. Brother Baleka will tell us how genetics and science led him to the connection of the Balanta people in the African country of Guinea-Bissau. He is also pioneering the use of transgenerational epigenetic effect and international law. He is the founder of the Balanta Society in America, the former African Union 6 Region Education Campaign Director, and author of 13 books, including the 5-volume, 1,500-page work entitled Come Out of Her, My People, 21st Century Black Prophetic Faith and Pan-African Diplomacy, as well as the 3-volume history of the Balanta people entitled Balanta Barasa, My Sons, Those Who Resist Remain. I'd like to bring in the two guests. We are in for a special treat. When I say your name, when I say the last 4 digits of your phone number, please state your name, the city, and state that you're calling from. The first person with the digits 5954, would you please state your name, city, and the state that you're calling from?
Dr. Clyde Winters, I'm calling from Chicago.
Thank you, Dr. Winters, and thank you for joining us, and welcome back to the show. Caller with the last four digits, 8360, will you please state your name and the city and state that you're calling from?
Greetings, Elena. This is Sipiwe Baleka, and I am calling from Springfield, Missouri.
Greetings. Thank you for joining us, Brother Sipiwe. I'm just going to yield the floor to you and Dr. Winters. And I'd like to yield the floor to Dr. Winters first because our audience here, and myself included, we will need a brief little introductory course on genetics. And Dr. Winters is a little bit more familiar with our audience, so I think he'll be able to break it down a little bit, you know, where we can understand it. Dr. Winters, would you give us a brief little introduction on the on genetics and how it affects our identity?
Okay, genetics are basically, they talk about the matrilineal or mtDNA, which is the gene that is passed on from the mother to her children. And then you have the Y chromosome. The Y chromosome is considered to be the male gene. And this gene is used, in a sense, to determine the father. Okay, in relation to the identity of foundational Black American, Native American, is basically genetics cannot really be used. And one of the reasons why genetics cannot be used is that genetics basically has one construct that makes it a falsified science. And that construct is genetic or population geneticists, they believe that Black people were not associated with any other people on Earth until 1492, when the slave trade, when the Spanish came to the Americas. This is false, because anybody who studied history knows that African people was ruling Spain for almost 1,000 years. That's right. African people had taken over Spain. They were the so-called Moors, and these Moors ruled from Iberia or Spain and Portugal all the way to Germany. That shows right there that the whole concept is false. And so what they did is that they used this idea that Black people carry this haplotype, and white people carry another haplotype, and then you have Asians, they carried another haplotype. And what they did is that they tried to divide the world into four different, you know, haplotypes or haplogroups. Okay, so then they said that Africans are only mtDNA L1 and Y chromosome E11A and stuff like that. They said white people were mtDNA H, mtDNA H, a couple others, and Y chromosome R. This is all false. African people carry all of these genes, you see, because of the fact that we were the ones who took the haplogroup into Europe. Okay, and so what happened is this. Back in the 1980s and the early 2000s, as many of the white Indians in Oklahoma were beginning to be able to make money based upon their so-called Indian heritage, what happened is they decided to be Black people who were the so-called freemen. And so when they pushed the freemen out of the tribes, they did this to make sure that Black people couldn't get none of that reparations money, $56 million, I think it was, for the Seminoles. And then, you know, the Cherokee, Chickasaw, and others were, you know, collecting monies off of the casinos. And so then what happened is that in around 2004, Rick Kettles, he has the African Ancestry group. And what he did is that he offered to help the freemen to prove that they were Indians or not Indians based upon their genetic profile. What he found, in a sense, is that most of the freemen only carried 6%, 6% so-called Native American genes. And as a result, they use this as a way to say, these black people don't deserve anything. But this is kind of funny because most white Indians who are on the Dalles Road in Oklahoma, they only carry 1% Indian blood. But that doesn't really matter. The main problem with trying to use genetics is that black people today and black people when they came over here slaves and when they came over here 100,000 years ago, yes, black people were here 100,000 years ago, these black people carried the same genes that we're carrying today. They carried L1 or M1 and the mtDNA, and they carried the R haplogroup, and they carried E. And so what happens is that naturally, when Rick Kettles did the research, and he found that that the freemen carried only 6% so-called Indian haplogroup, that's because the so-called Indian haplogroups are really not the genes carried by most of the black people, but black people still carry those genes too. You have to understand. Let me explain to you. What happened is this. Many of the black people moved to the East Coast. The so-called five civilized tribes, I'm going to try to make this quick. The so-called five civilized tribes, some of them had been in Florida for hundreds of years, but many of the five civilized tribes, like Manitoke and others, they had been recently moved from the Midwest into North Carolina, Florida, and Georgia. What happened is this. Many of the Mongoloid Indians, as they migrated down from the Beringa or the Beringa Straits, as they migrated across the Beringa Straits into Alaska, they came down to California, Oregon, and they went into Mexico. And they stayed in Mexico. Okay, but see, remember, Mongoloid Indians were basically nomadic. And because they were nomadic, that meant that they specialized in hunting and gathering. Okay, because they specialized in hunting and gathering, what they did in a sense is that they had severe droughts down in Mexico, and so many of these people couldn't really dominate down there, so they migrated back into the southwest United States, and they began to migrate into the Midwest until they got to the eastern shore. What happened is that many of these Mongoloid Indians were adopted. Let me repeat. They were adopted by the black Indians who made up, in a sense, the five civilized tribes. They adopted these people. But if you go back and read the literature, you'll find it was a Mongoloid village next to a black Indian village. Okay, so what happened is that, you know, many of the black people like the Tuscarosa and some of the other groups, many of them were sold into slavery right up, you know, straight up. You know, as you remember from the second Thanksgiving, they invited the black Native Americans to a Thanksgiving dinner, and they killed many of them. Those they didn't kill, they took the women and the children, and they made them slaves because the women and children were good agriculture workers. And many of the men they didn't kill, they sold to the Bahamas. Then decimate the entire tribes. Okay, and so what happened is that over the years, as slavery became an institution, and they began, in a sense, to bring Africans from Africa to replace the black Indian slaves, many of the black Indian slaves, what they did, in a sense, is that they said, you know, we're going to use the Mongoloid Indians as a buffer. See, white people use Mongoloid Indians as a buffer because, you know, Mongoloid Indians were light, and so they were almost white, so they just made them honorary white. And they made them honorary white based upon I'm white and I say so. So if you're white, whatever you say is right. So what happened is that many of these black, five civilized tribal people, they said, aha. They said, what we'll do is that we'll pretend we're the slaves of the Mongoloid Indians. So that way the white man can't enslave. We still enslave them. Because when you really look at the increase in the so-called colored population, you can see they were still enslaving these African slaves. I mean, these black Native American Indians. And so what happened is, and so when Andrew Jackson, when President Jackson decided he was going to send all the Indians to the Indian Territory in 1836, many, the vast majority of Black Native Americans, they didn't go on that cross. They didn't march all the way to Oklahoma. Most of them, in a sense, remained in Georgia, Georgia, Virginia, Florida, places like that, North Carolina, South Carolina. They didn't migrate. And so then these Black freedmen, they were not really slaves. You see, they weren't their slaves, but the Mongoloid Indians, they kind of, were able, in a sense, to maintain that they were their slaves, so the government looked at them as slaves. And so then what happened is that after the Civil War, even though the Mongoloid Indians knew this, they still betrayed us. They always betrayed us. See, I'm going to tell you something. Foundational Black Americans have no ally. Every ally that we try to form a relationship with always stabs us in the back. And because they always stab us in the back, you can't really rely on them to fight for you. We have to fight for ourselves. And so what happened is that in 1906, as you remember, they did the Dow's tally. And then the Dow's tally, white people, they could say $5 and become an Indian. And, most of the Black people, the Black freemen, they just pushed them out and said, oh, we're not going to recognize you as Indian. And then some of the Black people who were recognized as Indians, they've still been pushed out of the tribe. So in a way, the genetics cannot be used to show who was a Black Indian, because the Black Indians carry the same genetic material that other Africans did. One of the interesting things is that many of the Mongoloid Indians carry Y chromosome R. Y chromosome R, really in a sense, they try to say it came from Europeans, but as the brother is about to talk, and he talks about the Volanta in the Chad area, and Guinea-Bissau, many of the people there carry R. And in fact, some of your earliest slave burials in the Caribbean are people who carry the R chromosome. So again, the reason that Black people cannot really use genetics as a tool is because of the idea that they say that Black people carry this gene, whereas white people carry that gene, and Indians are different genes. And this is all bull. Every gene that exists, Africans had it first. And that as white people and Mongoloid Indians and Mongoloid people in Asia intermarried with us, and they were able, in a sense, to get those genes. That's why genes cannot identify racial groups. You see, so-called ancestry, groups, even so-called African ancestry group ran by Rich Heddle, they maintain that they can really, in a sense, show you or tell you where you came from in Africa. But that's bull. They can't identify where you came from in Africa. All they do is do a statistical look. And what I mean by a statistical look is that they look and they say, aha, this percentage of the genome was carried by this group. But they can't really do that because, there's so many different groups that carry so much, different DNAs. I mean, if you look at when they tried to do something on the Answers Man, they found, in a sense, that he was really R, but they say he's Q. You see, they say that in a sense, the most ancient Mexican, Naya, they say that she was D4. Aha! But see, D4 is really the Asian name of M1. See, what the white man does is that the white man will name, the white man will give a gene a name for African people, and then the same gene carried by white people or carried by Asians, they'll give it another name, nomenclature. And that's just to throw you off. And if you don't really go back and read the literature that they wrote about these genes back in the early 2000s, you won't know what's going on. But see, many people, they like direct-to-consumer or genetic tests because they feel that genetic tests can show your genetic ancestry, which is false. They can't show your specific genetic ancestry. Many people like to get a direct to our consumer genetic test because it provides them with a personal identity. It makes them feel, aha, I must belong to this group or that group. Then you have an also provide you with some type of cultural membership. But most importantly, what it is in a sense is that most of the time the courts, they would not accept a genetics test to prove your ancestry, especially in relation to the native or indigenous people, because most indigenous nations have a sovereignty, a self-sovereignty, and secondly, they got a charge in the white man. And if the white man say you Indian, you Indian. If the white man say you Negro, you Negro. It's why did I say so.
Brother Seifway, would you like to respond? And also, please, Brother Seifway, tell us a little bit about your work, about how genetics led you to the Balanta tribe and what it has done for you. But first, I would like you to respond to Dr. Winters.
Well, Dr. Winters, rangy, I mean, he touched on a lot of things. I think just maybe our approaches are a little different. I am not trying to prove or disprove Aboriginal or Native American ancestry or connection to myself personally or just to Afro-descendants generally. That's not my approach. He did mention something about, he touched a little bit on the genetic science. I would just like to clarify for people that there really are four types of DNA, and there's two different groups. There's the DNA that is what we call non-recombinant, meaning it doesn't combine with other DNA in reproduction. So when someone marries into your family and they produce offspring, there's non-recombinant DNA, which is mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosomal DNA. Since it never combines or changes, just on a very basic, simple level that even my 9-year-old can understand, it means that I have given to my son something intact that came from my father, that came from his father, that came from his father, and so on in an unbroken line. And so therefore, the non-recombinant DNA can be used to identify who your ancestors are going back, you know, thousands of years. And that's the same for mitochondrial DNA that's passed down from mother to children, and so from mother to daughter. So there's the kind of DNA that is the hardest actual, it identifies you more than anything on this planet. It identifies you more than a birth certificate. It identifies you more than any kind of theory or information in a book. It is recorded in your placenta, but that genetic material, right, is the one thing that you have that connects you to what we call your ancestral lineage. So it can be used as a tool. That's what it is. It's a tool. It's not going to solve all problems, but it can be used and has been used, and I personally have used it to identify my ancestors and be able to find out my narrative. I heard Dr. Winters, you know, I can't comment on a lot of the things that he presented. I don't study the connection between Afro-descendants who were brought here from Africa and their relationship with those aboriginals who were already here. I don't deny that, of course. My concern is, how do I know if what Dr. Winters is presenting in that narrative, it actually applies to me and my actual story? And that's true whether if I were to run up into a Moorish camp, well, they have a narrative, right? Claiming that we are all Moors. If I were to go up into a Hebrew Israelite camp, They have a narrative. I'm not here to defend or dispute any of those narratives. I believe that there are truths. There are some people that are actually Moors. There are some people who actually are descendant. Their ancestral Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA, right, comes from people who were here long before the Europeans, right? There are some people who are descendant from, we'll just, for lack of a better term, Jewish or Israelite cultures. The question for me, and this goes into my personal story, which you asked me, the question for me is, how do I know which one of those narratives applies to me?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll talk about my story. Like most Afro-descendant people in the United States, we were miseducated, and regardless of which camp or group you think you are in, we have been the victim of the crime of ethnocide, meaning, right, we have been deliberately, we've had our identities destroyed. And so what we're all kind of collectively doing on some intuitive, spiritual, psychological, emotional, and physical level, we are attempting to reclaim the identity that was destroyed by the crime of ethnocide. And so what we do, we go on our journeys and we read, we study, we read these things. And if something resonates us, a lot of times we will appropriate those narratives because they resonate with us. But I wanted to go beyond that. I didn't want to just read something and say, okay, I'm that, without really trying to find evidence or proof. Now, in my family, my great-granduncle, Uncle Eustace, was a great patriarch of our family, right? He was the 44th pastor of the AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church, that great institution founded by Richard Allen in the late 1700s. My great-granduncle was the 44th pastor of that foundational mother church. He was a very learned man. He was responsible for, you know, a flock. 74, on his deathbed, he gathered the family together. He sort of gave our family history. And he said, you know, you are descended from his father was Jack and his father was George. And he said, we have it from word of mouth that we are descended from the Zulu people. And that our patriarch, who had married a woman, she was from the Timote tribe from Venezuela. So according to our most esteemed ancestor at that time, he was telling us that we were a mix between the Zulu and the Timote people. And I had to do some research to even find out who these people were, and it's a small tribe coming out of Venezuela. So based on that narrative of someone that is educated, you know, like Dr. Winters, he had me and our family believing that we were descended from Zulus. So I spent a lot of time studying, right, the slave trade from East South Africa, went to South Africa. I discovered that, you know, our surnames, our slave names is Blake, B-L-A-K-E, which is an English surname. So I started doing some research, and I discovered that, yes, British, they didn't, you know, they would bypass West Africa, sail around the southern tip of the Cape of Good Hope, and go to the eastern side of South Africa. And during this period, from about the 1730s to the 1790s, because they did not have an Asiento contract with the Catholic Church, and they were not allowed to legally engage in trafficking of African descendant people. Because it was illegal for them to do that, they would bypass the Portuguese, the Dutch, and the French, and they indeed would go to what we call South Africa today. So I was doing this research, and I was like, okay, well, you know, there's some evidence for this time period. It's plausible. We have an English last name, so it makes sense to me. So, you know, I went to South Africa in 2006, and, you know, believing that I was returning to my ancestral homeland because I had this narrative, but I had no proof. And that's what actually led me to take the African ancestry DNA test, which is what they call an autosomal DNA test. Autosomal is the DNA that is called recombinant. That's the DNA that combine when you marry and reproduce with someone, your DNAs mix. Okay, most of the commercial testing that Dr. Winters talks about is autosomal DNA testing, and I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Mm-hmm. Like Dr. Winters, I'm like, that's not helpful at all. An ancestry test, though, is not autosomal. It's looking at the non-recombinant DNA that is unchanged from the beginning of your history. So I took the test hoping to confirm this narrative that this learned man in our family, who was a professor and who was a, you know, a pastor and a very well-respected person, he was saying our family. I wanted to confirm what he was saying. And when I took the test, it came back that I had what African ancestry calls a similarity with Balanta on the paternal side. Now, that in and of itself didn't prove anything to me, right? Now I have an alternative narrative, and I still don't know whether the narrative I got from my great-granduncle Eustace, the narrative I got coming out of the Moorish camp, the narrative I get coming out of the Rastafari camp, the narrative I get coming out of the Hebrew Israelite camp, the narrative I get coming out of the Aboriginal, I still don't know how to determine which one of those narratives actually applies to me, like historically, like in fact. So I used the testing that said, hey, you're 100% match with Balanta, to then start doing genealogy work, right? Mm-hmm. And I can name my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, right, going all the way back to Brasa and Chabra, right, who, by doing this work, I discovered, right, was in fact taken as a boy around the age of 8 years old, right, captured in Nacra, his homeland, Guinea-Bissau, brought to the port of Charleston, South Carolina, was sold at the auction of Henry Lawrence, right, and was, for lack of a better word, enslaved by this Blake family. Mm-hmm. And so by using both the tool of the African ancestry DNA test and genealogy, and then going to Guinea-Bissau, right? And, you know, as African people, we have faculties that go beyond the white man's faculties, where his only faculty is just what we call intellectual, and then he writes it on a piece of paper. Well, we have oral histories, and then we have non-intellectual faculties where we're able to access information that doesn't exist in books. And so in going to Guinea-Bissau and accessing that source of information, it was able to confirm, right, the actual truth of my family and who my father's 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 father, 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 father was. And then once I understood that, I could then study the history of Balanta people, again, using genetic science and rereading African history to reconstruct my ancient family history. And so now, right, when Dr. Winter says you can't use this as a tool, well, maybe he can't, but I have already done it. I've already used it as a tool. And I now have a narrative, right? It could still, at some future point, be disproven if there's a greater science, a greater technology, or a new discovery. But at this point in time in history, right, all of the available resources that are available to me, genetic, documented, what we call Inseca, right, or consulting the ancestral realm, if you take all of that, for me right now, it's all in alignment and it all confirms each other. And so that's what I hope a lot of my work now is, helping other people use all of the tools, right, to be able to answer the question for themselves. What is my history? Right? Mm-hmm. Did I have an ancestor that survived the Middle Passage? And if so, who was he or she, right? Because if you have an ancestor that survived the Middle Passage, that ancestor came from a specific family that lived in a specific territory, that practiced, spoke a specific language, and practiced a specific culture. And if you are an Afro-descendant whose ancestors survived the Middle Passage, that is what was taken from you. And reclaiming that is your birthright. And many Afro-descendant people in America want to answer that question. They want to know, is that my story? And if so, which language did I speak? What land and territory did I come from? And what actually happened? And now we can answer those questions in a way that we couldn't before. So I'll just stop there, and maybe later on in the conversation, we'll get into the actual science of, right, there's the genetic science, and then there's what I call ancestral science, which is, some people, they talk about, they use the word ancestor worship. I don't like the word worship. I like to talk about the ancestral science, and just by way of introduction, what I mean by that is most people, they know physical science, like anatomy and biology. They can name the parts of their physical body. They've learned a little bit about how all of those parts and systems work according to universal laws and principles that govern physical matter. But we are not just physical human beings. We're energetic human beings. Most of us have never been taught and can't name what's our energetic anatomy. What are the different parts and systems, and how do they work and function according to universal laws and principles? And once you start to learn ancestral science, right, mm-hmm. then a whole new realm opens up where you understand the relationship between those of us on Earth, those of us in the ancestral realm, and how we can communicate, and how the fundamental key to that, right, is knowing the language that your experiences were encoded in for most of your history. So I'll just kind of pause there and see where this conversation goes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm going to yield the floor back to Dr. Winters, because he always specified the importance of linguistics. Dr. Winters, would you care to respond? And then I'm going to bring on Brother Issa as well.
Oh, okay. I'm going to respond. I'll do the linguistic thing in a couple of minutes, but I want to respond to what he just said. First of all, if they tell you from African ancestry that your DNA was 100% Balanta, they can't do that. They when you do any type of genetic study, a lot of other different ancestries will come up. So if they tell you 100%, that's a lie.
You misrepresented what I said. And so before you go any further, I just want to clarify so that we can be on the same page. What I said was the African ancestry sequence similarity score was 100% match. I was very specific in what I said.
It can't be 100% match. Hina Wallajahi, she did a paper called Constructing Identities, the Implication of DTC Ancestry Testing for Tribal Communities. It was published in the Genetic Medicine magazine in 2019, August 21-8. Okay, as it points out, is that they can't give you any absolute identification of where you came from, because once they do a run, it's going to be many different ancestries. Okay, and another thing is this, is that that's just a way to take people money. Secondly, I can't really dispute what your uncle said. I'm a researcher. I do original research. Okay, many people when they look at the number of black people that came to America, they usually refer to the Emory University Boreas database table. This thing it's false. It doesn't even count. And the Emory figure for slaves from East Africa was only about 65,000. But in reality, in 1680, the first Malagasy slaves, because they used to bring slaves not directly from South Africa, they brought them either from Mozambique, and then they took them to Malagasy. And then from there, they brought them to the Americas. And Mannix and Coley, they reported in 1683 that the Royal African Society, they brought over, in a sense, 5,400 slaves. And so many of these slaves, they would go into the interior. They would march from Mozambique into South Africa, kidnap slaves, bring them to the coast, and bring them to America. We find, in a sense, that as many as 205,000 slaves came from Madagascar and Mozambique between 1680 and 1725. Many of them may have been related to the Zulu that your uncle was referring to. See, the most important thing you have to remember is that white people lie about our history. Rick Kettles is okay, but Rick Kettles is a member of the status quo. He teaches you whatever he believes white folks want you to know. He's not going to tell you the truth. He's not going to do any original research. And as I'm telling you, what they use, in a sense, to analyze DNA material, they use what's called the Eugene statistics. What they do is that they form a model, and they tell you what you want to hear, you see. And so then, therefore, in a sense, I'm not saying that one of your ancestors was not a Blanca. That could be true, you see. I mean, they're an interesting group of people, and they have a very distinctive history, because I've been studying African history and all that stuff for 40 years. But the thing is that when it comes to genetic tests, they cannot pinpoint where you specifically came from. Because when they do a run, they have all these percentages from different groups. Yes, African ancestry has the largest database, but you can't point out a specific tribe. They're lying to you. They're lying to you. I mean,
well, Doctor Winters, how came from the Zulus too. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How then do you explain that when African ancestry said that I had a sequence similarity score of 100% that matched Balanta, and then when I did my own independent research, right, beyond the genetics, they were actually right?
Okay, because the thing is this, is that you assume it's right because you did find this ancestor. But the point is this, is that back in America, they didn't just get slaves from one place. Americans, they took slaves from everywhere. You see, therefore, in the sense of that, yeah, let me finish. Yeah, but see, you don't know what other percentages they found. They only, you know, African ancestry, they're real slick. What they do is that instead of giving you a full profile, like most profiles show, you get about 20% here, 5% there, 7% here. In terms of when they do a run, African ancestry, they'll give you this specific group, and that's a lie. Nobody has 100% anything. You see?
Okay,
the presentation. Go ahead. I'm not saying you're not Blanca.
Yeah.
I'm not saying.
Yeah, right. But, okay. So, again, right, we
go
need
ahead.
To understand that there are basically two kinds of DNA testing. One is can tell you general location, can tell you the non-recombinant DNA that you carry, okay? So that's the first thing, okay? Some of us, we're not interested in getting our full genetic profile to determine who all of our ancestors were. Some of us, our main concern is answering the question, did I have an ancestor that survived the Middle Passage? And if so, where did the ancestor come from?
Okay.
That's the question we're trying to answer. And what I'm saying is, for me, I guess what I was wanting you to address is, I was able to use the tool of African Ancestry's test and combine it with other tools to actually answer the question.
Yeah. And the point is,
all I'm saying is that we can now encourage people to make the same effort. They may be able to answer the question, or they may not. But we now have success stories that show that this testing can be immensely useful in answering that question.
Okay.
And I know that there are most of the Afro-descendant people in America, right, they do want to know, because of their miseducation and because of this, what is the truth? And how, my question to you is, how can someone take the information from your book and know for sure that that applies to them, that I descend from an Olmec?
Okay. Now, I didn't say anybody descends from an Olmec. But what I'd like to say is this, that you have to remember this, is that when these British, not mainly British, a lot of Americans who did the stuff, what they did is they would come around and they would kidnap people and they would bring them to America. Usually, When those slave traders brought people to the United States, they would give a broad standard. Or they're West African or East African. They rarely did they mention specific locations where they got the slaves, like what villages and things like that. They just may have said, we got them from the Grand Coast, we got them from the whatever coast. But the thing is, this is
yeah. When
what
it comes to the British,
is,
I don't. Yeah, I agree.
I just wanted to say I agree with you.
When it comes to the British records, I agree with you.
I just told you that the British records say, in a sense, that only 25,000 people came from East Africa. When my research, and I've done the research, shows that 205,000 came. What I'm telling you in a sense is that African ancestry, as the research shows, that they're lying. Maybe you probably may have an ancestor that's a Balanta. I'm not saying you don't, but the point is that they didn't put in those records that they got X amount of slaves that were Balanta tribe or Mandi tribe or whatever. What they did is that they put general situation where they came from, then they did it. Okay, therefore, like my father. Okay. My father's brought to Mississippi by the Winters family. Winters is a German name, right? Winter. Okay, so then I know that my father's great-grandfather, they were a bunch of mulattoes, and they came there, and they were slaves. But I know they were brought there from the Winters. They were part of the Winters family. But on my mother's side and my grandmother's side, they were Choctaws, and therefore they intermarried. What I'm trying to tell you is that I'm not trying to deny that there could have been a Balanta in your history, but what I'm trying to say is that there's no way that you can prove that you have authentic records that identify a person coming from the Balanta tribe. They mention tribe generally. You see, I've read the document. You see, I'm not a Jew.
Hold on, you read which document?
I read the general documents relating to the slave trade. And the point,
okay,
and the point
so,
is this.
Okay, so, all right.
But,
yeah, we have to.
It's okay.
Well, I want to respond. Can I respond to the point you made about the bridge? First of all, right, I'm not in contention with you, right? I'm not here to debate and be adversarial. Where there's points that we agree, right, where there's points that we agree, I want to emphasize them. And I agree. You're absolutely right. When it comes to the British records, they didn't specify unlike the Dutch, Portuguese, and French. And the reason for that is because, again, during that period where they were taking people from Senegambia, it was illegal for the British, because they didn't have a monopoly contract called the Atiento with the Catholic Church. Since their trading on the west coast of Africa was illegal, it's properly called pirateering. They didn't want to leave records of their criminal actions that could then be used in court. So this is the reason why, for example, if you look in the French records in Central and South America, or if you look at the Portuguese records, they did in fact list specifically, we took people from here and they had tribes. And if you look at Gwendolyn Mito's research, she goes into great details, right, about the capacity of the various countries' records in identifying actual people, territories, and ethnicities. But you're right. The British totally undercounted, very poor records, and I just explained the reason why. However, right, again, and I agree with you. I hear you, you know, talking about the limitations of what we call the colorless people. If they're going to call us people of color, I call them colorless people. Well, you right, the white people,
yeah.
Right? We don't put any stock or basis into the white people's records or versions of them as if they're the end all be all. What I was attempting to do was to elevate that we have a form of records that they don't recognize as legitimate, but as African people, right? They are, and so when we consult those, that's part of the missing link that people have to use in order to reconstruct their actual lineage histories. So I just that was the point I wanted to make.
Well, I know that's a very important point, and I agree. But as I said earlier, I just don't want people to be wasting up money sending into African ancestry and these other places, and then they're going to tell you where you specifically came from, when most of the time it cannot be supported. And as I said, I mentioned a specific article, and there are several other articles that explain that what these companies are doing is, in a sense, in a way, fraud. Let me get. I want to get to
the money that I spent. I don't consider it a waste, and it did, in fact, help me to not only make the identification, but it has had profound effects, positive effects in my life.
But and that's the beauty of it. I mean, back in the day, I remember, you know, back when me and my wife when we were young, we always talk about the fact the white men took our language, blah blah blah. You know, most of her ancestors on her mother and father's side were basically Cherokee, Blackfeet, and her great grandmother, all they said, she spoke Indian, so they didn't know what the hell she was saying. But the thing is, this is that it's very important to understand. Is that, see, when the white man pretends that he took your history, see, I do research. And because I do research, I've tried to go away from the white supremacist hegemony of history. You see, for example, when you talk about the linguistics research, we can look at the research of Constantine Samuel Raffanese and Leo Viner. And Constantine Raffanese, he's very important in the sense that he was an autodidact. Who excelled in various fields of knowledge. He was a zoologist, a botanist, and a linguist. Well, he published a thing called the Atlantic Journal. And in the Atlantic Journal, he gave a very beautiful article. And this article was called Negro Nations. And what he did is that he discussed all the black nations that were in the on the American continent when the Europeans came. In fact, he was able to do some linguistic research, and he pointed out that the Arua, people who lived in South America, Northern South America, they spoke the Ashanti language. Ah. And so then I used that research back in the day, and he did another thing called Olotun writing. But see, the most important person was Leo Viner. And what Leo Viner did is that he was able to show that the substratum, when I talk about a substratum language, that means the language is under the surface of the total language. For example, black people in America, we speak Ebonics. Okay. That's what they call ebony sounds. You know, they used to call it an Afro-American language. Okay, but see, when you study African, when you study the speech of Afro-Americans, you find in a sense that although we use an English vocabulary, we have what's called a Niger-Congo grammar. So the way that we form words is based upon how we did it in Africa. That's one of the reasons why we have a lot of contractions. We don't pronounce certain words. A lot of times instead of TH, we'll say S, like, you know, and stuff like that. Okay, and so what happened is that the O'Brien, he found that when you go up under the Mayan language, and when you look at the Aztec language, these people, they most of their vocabulary was Mandingo. I'm what's called a falsificationist. Well, you know, when I went to do my PhD, you always have to decide who and what you want to do. So I said, I'm a falsificationist. Okay. What a falsificationist does is that he looks at the data and he either confirms or disconfirms the information. And see, so what happened is that I took this research of Leo Viner and this idea that the Mandingo, that much of the Mayan language, the Aztec language, Mandingo, and I found and I confirmed it. See, when Ivan Van Sertima did his book, he only read volume one. See, because he didn't read the other two volumes, he didn't know to what extent it was. But one of the interesting things in Leo Viner's book was that Leo Viner, he talked about a statuette from Tuxtla, Mexico, and this statuette was formed by the Olmecs. Ah, okay, so it had various inscriptions on it, and because of the fact that Leo Viner had said that the Aztecs and the Maya spoke Mandingo, I said, aha. And then I noticed on the statuette that the symbols were the same symbols used by the Bai in West Africa. And I said, aha. Maybe these symbols can be read using the Manika or Maliki Bambara language, and they weren't. But see, the interesting point about this is that I found in a sense that not only did the Olmec speak a Mandingo language, the Nanticoke that used to live on the eastern shore of the United States, they also spoke a Mandingo language. You see, and the interesting thing is this: is when we talk about the Nanticoke, we had to look at these people. And so the Manicoke people, you know, they're a major group on the eastern seaboard of the United States. Okay, the interesting thing is that this tribe of black Native Americans formerly lived on the Chesapeake Bay in Delaware. They later fled to Wyoming and Oklahoma and Canada. One reason that many of the Nanticoke had left the eastern shore is that during the Revolutionary War, they sided with the British. And because they sided with the British, they had to kind of get out of town. But the Nanticoke, they have two origin traditions. The first is that they formerly lived in the central United States and migrated eastward 300 years before the coming of the Europeans to avoid incessant warfare. This warfare in the Midwest was mainly between Mongoloid Indians and black Native Americans as Mongoloid Indians tried to take our land. Due to this warfare, they began to migrate from the central United States to the shores of the Chesapeake. The interesting thing about this tradition is that it would place their origin in the central United States around the time Abu Bakari. Abu Bakari was the ruler of Mali, and Abu Bakari, he set sail in 1310 to the western coast, and we find that these Mandingo people, they left inscriptions all up and down the Mississippi River. They left inscriptions in Brazil, Mexico, et cetera. Okay, so another...
Can I stop you for a moment?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So I find all of this fascinating, as many of our people do. Fascinating. And I'm not here to really talk on all of that. The relevant question for a lot of us is, where do I place myself in all of that you're explaining? Does that relate directly to me? Am I not a part of that? Okay, so that's, I think, becoming – hold on. That's sort of illustrates the different approaches. previously, a lot of us studied African history or world history or African-American history or Native American history generally. But when we do that, we don't know how to orientate ourselves to that information because we don't know where we fit into it. Now, let me give you a very specific example, okay? For example, and I believe you will agree with me, right? A good number of those Niger-Congo speakers, including my Balanta ancestors, we know that our most ancient history starts with Mount Ruwenzori, the Mountains of the Moon. I'm sure you will agree with that, correct?
Okay, I'll agree. But even though I'll agree, go ahead.
Well, all I'm saying is we didn't just start in Upper Kemet, right? No, there were groups of people that migrated down the Nile into those areas, okay? Now, based on the knowledge that I was able to find out and the original research that I did and published in my three-volume work that's being translated by the National Institute of Guinea-Bissau, we learned that the ancient Balanta ancestors had migrated down the Nile Valley. They had, by around 18,000 BC, they had settled in what's called Wadi Kubania, and eventually they had migrated to what we call the land of Ta-Nehisi, right, and were part of the Nekan Confederacy before Narmer's invasion and before the first dynasty. And we learned that the Balanta ancestors got into a conflict with the Mesinu people, who later went on to establish the cult of Horus in ancient Kemet. And these were one of the first groups to master the science of using and smelting and working with iron. And they created these iron weapons for the first time. And as a result of that knowledge and that capacity, right, they upset the Nekan Confederation and tried to dominate the people in that area, including my ancient Balanta ancestors. As a result of this, right, the Balanta ancestors migrated from the Nile Valley before the first dynasty in Kemet, okay? So at one point in my life, like a lot of us, I started studying ancient Kemet because that's one of our most prideful, glorifying things, right? And then later on I come to realize that the only thing that my ancestors had to do with ancient Kemet is that they contributed the pre-dynastic culture that was then able to go on and do the things that we see on the stone and the, you know, and the pyramids and those texts and things. So now I'm orientated to that history with Kemet. Ah, this is what happened after my ancestors left that the Nile Valley. Then when we migrated across from Nile Valley to where we are in Guinea-Bissau, there's the whole migration history. And you mentioned the Mali Kingdom, right? I remember when the Mali Kingdom was presented to me as something good and positive. And we talked about Mansa Musa being the richest, you know, person in the history of the world. And it was always presented to me as this thing. And then I realized, well, actually, right, the Mali, Mansa Musa and many of those Mali and kings and rulers, they were slave trading imperialists. And
they never sold slaves.
Well,
Mandinka never sold slaves. The Tuareg sold slaves.
Let me respond to that.
Okay.
You talk about not crediting the colorless white people sources. Well, we have our own Balanta sources, right?
Mm-hmm.
And from the Balanta at the center of world history and our narrative, what you just said is a lie. They, in fact, did trade to the Tuaregs, to Arab slave traders coming from Saudi Arabia and that area. They did. And that's how they mined the gold. And it was the direct conflict between the Mande-speaking Mandinko and the Balanta. That's what forced Balanta to migrate to where they are in Guinea-Bissau, because they refused and resisted being conquered, dominated, and enslaved by the Mali Empire rulers. Now, if I don't know how how to situate myself in that. Can you imagine my Balanta ancestors in the ancestral realm seeing one of their descendants glorifying the very people that waged war on them and tried to enslave them? So we now have the ability to reread African history from a more nuanced, more informed position because we have new tools, we have new technologies, and that's what history is. It's a constant going back, right, using what's available to you at that time and reinterpreting it based on the evidence. Some narratives are more plausible or more have more explanatory power than others. So you had mentioned the Mali Empire. So I was wanting to show you one of the benefits of doing the kind of research that we teach our members to do is you can actually then begin to articulate not general history of the world or general history of Africa, but your history.
Brother Balaka and Dr. Winters, I have a caller, Brother Issa, I would like to bring in on the call and also respond as well or ask questions. Brother Issa?
Peace. How's everybody doing, Dr. Winters? I didn't catch the other brother's name, how to pronounce it. Sipaway. Okay, yeah. Great conversation you two are having. And I did read, I do have like two books from Dr. Winters here. And I agree in part with both. And I'm coming from it from the forensic science perspective. I have a specialization in forensic science as part of my criminal justice degree. And I think Dr. Winters brings a very good perspective in regards to the ancestry DNA test. One of the things that a lot of people don't know, and I think Dr. Winters was commenting on it in a roundabout way, is that those databases that they use are only to say what you are is only as good as the database is. So, for example, and it's the interpretation because I called up and contacted a lot of the ancestry companies, and there's a few tribes in South America. One of them is called the Suri tribe. And the Suri tribe actually has – their ancestry goes back to the what they call the Polynesian Australoids who came by way of the Pacific Ocean to the Americas. This is one of the migrations to the Americas. And their ancestry is related to the people from Papua New Guinea, from the Andaman Islands and around that area. And these are very dark complexion people. In the Philippines, they call them the Negritos. And in other parts, they call them part of the people called Moros as well. So these are very dark complexion people who, if you look at them, you'd call them African, but they come from this part of the world. And one of the things is in America, that tribe I mentioned, the Suri tribe, they wouldn't be necessarily categorized as Native American because what they're using for as a source DNA would be what they call Clovis. This is what they use for most of what they call Native Americans today. And so when you look at that, what source DNA are they using to categorize people belonging to this tribe or to this group of people? And I think the brother had brought up about recombinant DNA. There's basically three types of DNA that they use. It's either the Y DNA, the mitochondrial DNA, or it's the autosomal DNA. And another method they use is they deal with haplogroup. And the haplogroup also has it because they're using modern people today that are living today to come up with some of these statistics that Dr. Winters was talking about. And that doesn't account for bottlenecks in population and population migrations. So when they talk about the DNA for these ancestry tests, they also do not – it's a proprietary secret. They don't allow people to look at the what's the word that's escaping me right now?
The raw data?
No, it's a word with an A. It's a mathematical word. I'm trying to – it's escaping my mind.
Oh, okay.
But basically, it's the method they use to decide what the statistics say, and it begins with an A. And for some reason, I'm having a brain freeze on it.
No worries.
Yeah, they don't allow anyone to look at that. So if you were to ask an ancestry company, how do you get to that determination, algorithm is the word I was looking for. They won't allow you to look at the algorithms to check it. And I think he brought up Dr. Winters brought up African DNA. That's Rick Kittle's company, I believe, if that's the same one. And I've also looked at some of the results that people show me from African DNA, and I'm familiar with looking at everybody's different results from different companies, 23andMe, Ancestry.com, etc. And even people overseas in North Africa, they deal with companies from Europe. And I have to say, looking at the African DNA, I have to agree with Dr. Winters that there's absolutes that's given in that information that really, if you know something about the way the DNA works, you can't get to those absolutes. It's nearly impossible to get to 100% anything. And one of the things I have a DNA forensic lab that I purchased on my own, the equipment. And when I went to school to learn about how to do DNA testing, the DNA testing that we use for ourselves, like if this is me, I could be, let's say if I left some of my DNA someplace and there was a crime and they try to connect it to me, that's a different process than Ancestry DNA. So we could come up with your personal DNA to say that was you. But when you start going back into your ancestry, you have so many ancestors. The further in time you go, back in time you go, that's the more ancestors that you have that it keeps splitting off. And that's why the algorithm aspect is so important, because you have to see how are they defining to come to that result, and they won't let you know that. So a lot of those ancestry DNA in academia, when you go to college or university, when you're dealing with biologists, they'll tell you that those tests are stretches, like they're stretches of what the information could truly tell you. So, I mean, when it comes to the whole DNA aspect of it, it has its place, but these companies, the mostly owned 23andMe and all these different companies, they're just making more profit off it than the real science is in it. And what's sad, here's the sad part to it. A lot of people today are basing a lot of their what they know about their history, they're switching to primary research over to this DNA research that they don't control. And once again, it goes into a system that somebody outside of their own people controls, and they make it sound good and look good, but they control the whole system. It's like if I have a Monopoly board game, I'm the one who wrote the rules to that game. So when you come and play, you play by my rules. And that's the same circumstance that when you start dealing with these ancestry DNA companies. But one of the things that I wanted to bring up for both speakers is when you talk about – I hear you talking about Africa and the like – and it's very, as an academic thing, to know about history and stuff, it's pretty good. But what about when you're talking about the plight of the foundational black Americans here in America, for the most part, as a body politic, how does connecting to Africa, per se, do anything for the plight of the body politic that's here in America?
Good question. Very good question. And I'll pose that question to Brother Sipawe. And then I'll yield back to Dr. Winter.
Okay. First of all, great commentary. I will answer your question about the utility of it for foundational black Americans. First, I want to ask you a quick question, just on a level. Do you agree that there is something that is unbroken that is passed from father to son to son to son to son genetically, that isn't mixed with anything?
Yeah, that's called Y-DNA.
Right, okay. I just wanted to make sure. So then theoretically, if you could identify this Y-DNA, right, you could, right, theoretically identify who your paternal people are.
Theoretically, yes.
Okay, so I just want to see if we can agree on that, okay? Because that's what African ancestry is attempting to do. And I agree with you. What you said about all these DNA testing companies and all your reservations, I share all of them. I've never taken any other DNA test. I'm not into the autosomal DNA testing. I don't think it's very useful. I wouldn't tell anybody to do that. When I speak, I'm speaking specifically coming from the fact that at least theoretically, if I can identify that Y chromosome or that mitochondrial DNA on the maternal side, then actual real clue as to my paternal and maternal ancestry. Now, let me answer your question about the political utility. Okay, first of all, I'm going to give you an example, a personal example. The Balanta people, when they've never had chiefs, leaders, or kings. This is well documented. Meaning, the highest level of sovereignty in Balanta society is the family unit. We don't have in our DNA, we don't know subservience. We've never submitted to a chief, leader, king, let alone a foreign power. At the time that European powers came to our homeland, right, it was a declared war by the Dum Diversus, declared by Pope Nicholas V in 1452, a declared war, which means, right, that the moment, right, my fifth-generation great-grandfather was captured, he became of war, okay? Knowing that, and knowing that when he was brought to Charleston, South Carolina, the law in Charleston, South Carolina said, the Negro Law of 1740 said that only people that were slaves in Africa could be enslaved in Charleston, South Carolina. And then it lists various exceptions, people that they knew were free people in Africa that you couldn't enslave. Now, the name Balanta wasn't on that list. But we know in history at this point that Balanta were free and sovereign people at that time. And an 8-year-old boy who can't speak English is not going to be able to effectively make his case when he arrives in Charleston, South Carolina. So according to South Carolina law, now that I know this, right, there is the legal case that, okay, he was misclassified according to their own law. Now, right, there are various domestic programs in the United States, right, that are used to transfer resources. I like to repurpose them as called micro-reparations. And in order to obtain them, you have to do it on an ethnic basis, okay? So when Dr. Winters is talking about all of these Native American groups, most of them are utilizing those micro, those resource transfers and those micro-reparations. They're utilizing them. Whereas foundational black Americans aren't, because they're still dealing with identifying their ethnicity. They don't know their original ethnicity, and they're attempting, right, to establish that they have a new ethnicity now, and they're trying to get that label, once again, foundational black American, before that Ados, before that African American, before that Negro, before that black, before that nigger, before that Guinea man, right? So that identity piece, right, not only does it have a detriment, right, to foundational black Americans because they haven't really settled that yet, right? In terms of politics, domestically, right, there are certain strategies or that you can pursue or that we're not pursuing, and certain territories that we're not getting victories and claiming because we are the victims of ethnocide. Now, in international law, the benefits are so great in international law if you can give your narrative that doesn't start from the slave ship, right? So we have standing in international law as Afro-descendants, which is a new standing, but we have further additional standing when you can make the case like I can personally say, listen, right, the declaration of war against my specific family was made in 1452 Here's the history. Here's the documents. Here's the scientific proof. And here's the international law that pertains to it. Now, this is just my brief introduction on this, but I talk a lot about not only that, there are, when you understand what's called the transgenerational epigenetic effect, how the dehumanizing slave manufacturing process has harmed your genetic endowment and turned it into an artificial genetic, okay, that was trained to be different from your natural genetic endowment, okay? That dehumanization process has never been reversed, okay? And so part of any kind of foundational Black American argument for reparations that goes beyond just getting a check, all the resources are supposed to be used for the rehumanizing process. And so there are all kinds of international legal strategies that we can now use that are based on transgenerational epigenetic effect, especially if you can identify what your genetic endowment was before the crime took place. In my particular case, I had a genetic endowment that never knew subservience. Okay? We'll call it, I had a sovereign genetic endowment, right? Because Balanta people were never enslaved. They were never had chiefs and leaders, right? So the head of the family was always free and sovereign, right? That subservience didn't enter my genome until Brasa and Chabra was brought in the 1760s and subjected to the dehumanization manufacturing process that changed my genetic endowment. Now it's possible to actually make those arguments in international forums saying that, hey, foundational Black Americans, right, you need the resources, right, to fix your DNA. Well, the dehumanization process took place in a controlled environment, and they used violence and terror and the monopoly of force, right, to genetically engineer this manufactured genes that you have now. So you're going to need a controlled environment and all of that. Now this gets into the land issue, the legal basis for claiming your territory. Just like Native Americans have 326, you know, autonomous land areas recognized by this government, and Gullah Geechee has one, right? Now, if you understand and you have a Balanta heritage or you have a Bamileke heritage, you can then say, okay, you can identify these are the conditions required to return to me what was destroyed and taken by the crime of ethnocide, including repairing the genetic damage. And this is my question for Dr. Winters, especially because he's an expert in linguistics. My understanding is that every experience we have, right, takes place in an actual environment on Earth. It has an electromagnetic vibration to it, for lack of a better word. And that experience is also processed, categorized, and indexed according to language. And the marriage of those two things, the environmental stimulus and the linguistic coding, is what gets encoded in your DNA. And it's when we talk about, you know, our genetic endowment or the wisdom contained in our genes. Well, the coding process required the environment and the language. So if you want to unlock that, you are going to have to actually go to the environment and use the language, right, to start decoding and activating that stuff in your DNA. I'd like to get Dr. Winter's thoughts on that.
Okay. Language in a sense is experience. I used to, when I would begin my linguistics class, I used to have a lot of women, you know, because most, it's kind of sad, but when I taught at Governor State for 10 years, most of my students were women. So in my linguistics class, I would always put on the board, I wanted them to understand the importance of words. So I would put on the board the word love, And so I would say, what do you guys think about love? And so a woman would say this, a woman would say that, you know, affection, companionship, and things like that. Then I would say, well, somebody look on your phone or something. What's the definition of love? And then the definition of love was have a strong attraction, sex, and affection. I said, aha, I said, none of you guys put that up there. But I said, that's what the word love means. But you're giving a word meanings that don't exist. Each word has a particular meaning. Okay, therefore, when you talk about this whole idea of language, culture, and experience, yes, our experiences determine our language. But we also have what's called a genetic memory. And some of us, in a sense, can tap into that memory when we have experiences that relate to those former activities. Okay, just
exactly.
This is what we get from our parents, our eye color, our ear shape, you know, our nose, some of our facial features. We also get those memories that go back, way back in time, to when
yes.
our ancestors came over here. And so then, but again, so that is absolutely true. But I want to go to that whole thing about micro reparations. This is what you have to understand. Micro reparations are based on treaties. The white man did not make treaties with most black Native Americans. They just took what the hell they wanted to and said, you're a Negro. They didn't make treaties with us. If you remember, when the Seminoles got that $56 million based on reparations, they got that reparations based on the fact that they had treaties with the United States. And so then that's why, in a sense, they said, aha, we're going to get the money, but you black folk, you get nothing, you see. And so then because of the fact that micro reparations depend on treaties, they didn't make treaties with us. It's going to be very difficult to use that as a method to move forward. Okay, in relation
there are
to
alternatives.
The body, yeah, in relation to the body politics and foundation of Black Americans, it's very important to understand, in a sense, that you have to look at what this means for us. I wrote an article once, and in the article I wrote that although prior to 6000 BC. 6,000 years ago, Americans carried the N1 haplogroup. Now today, no Native Americans carry the N1 haplogroup. One of the reviewers of a peer-reviewed journal, and they wrote me back and said, you're wrong. How can you say that, Dr. Winter? You're wrong. Because he said A, C, D, these are all M haplogroups. You see, but I didn't know that. I was a novice at that time in terms of the relationship. And so what that taught me is that I had to do really further research. Okay, the brother, he brought up the Suri. The Suri, they claim, are related to Anzik Man. Anzik Man carried haplogroup D4 and Y chromosome Q. Aha. But see, that's bull. It's bullshit. Excuse me. Because, see, when you really look at the breakdown, when they analyzed the genome of Anzik Man, most of it was R haplogroup. But they decided when they did a count, they decided we're not going to say Anzik Man was R haplogroup because then that would make him more related to Europeans. That's why they always say the most ancient Americans are related to the Europeans because they carry R. So instead of labeling Anzik Man R, they labeled him Q. Okay. Then on top of that, they say Anzik Man was D4. The D haplogroup is nothing but the Asian name for the M1 haplogroup. So in other words, Anzik Man is carrying the same genes, 22%, and even some of the Balata, over there in Africa carry the YR haplogroup. But so we can see that there's a direct relationship between Anzik Man, who represents the Clovis people, and Black Americans today, you see. But again, if we use the way white people do genetic research to try to define ourselves, we're going to lose because they're going to say I'm right and I say so, and I say that that's a nigger, and he's a so and so.
No, I agree with you. We should not be using the white man way of doing research or their frameworks or anything. But is the brother that was asked the question? Is he still on the?
Yeah,
brother,
He didn't hang up. He just got quiet. Why don't you ask him a question? He can.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the brother the question. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. But my question to you is, especially since you brought up Foundational Black American, right? Did your maternal or the Middle Passage?
You're breaking up.
My question to you is, did either one of your maternal or paternal ancestors, on either your paternal lineage or your maternal lineage, did either of them survive the Middle Passage?
It would probably be on my maternal side.
Don't know?
No, I'm on my maternal side. I know that they're from Florida. They're from the Seminole people of Florida.
My question is real specific. Did either your maternal or paternal ancestor survive the Middle Passage?
I don't know. It would be an assumption to say they have, because it would be an assumption saying that they were descended from slavery.
That's what I'm saying. It's an assumption one way or another. This is the essential problem of Foundational Black Americans. And my question to you is, do you want to know?
There is no problem.
Hold on, I want the brother to answer this question. My question to him is, do you want to know?
Do I want to know? I mean,
yes.
I guess if I research my own family tree, but from the oral traditions from my family and some of the stuff I was able to look up, I haven't found anything that indicates that.
But my original question to you was, is either your maternal or paternal? And you gave an honest answer. You said, I don't know.
I understand the question, but I'm saying I don't know personally. I have to go by what I was told, which is oral tradition.
That's what I'm saying. Right. You don't know. And my question to you is real simple. Do you want to know? Who wouldn't say yes? I want to know.
Here's the thing. I mean, yes, but right now, is it the priority that I have? It's not a priority.
I didn't ask that. You see how whenever it gets to this issue, people always they reframe it. I just make it real simple. I didn't say is it your main priority. I just asked you, do you know, and do you want to know? If the answer is yes, I want to know, then that's what I like to talk about. How do you find out?
What process can you go through to
find out? We can help with that process. Can't guarantee we're going to get you an answer, but
let me have provided answers.
Okay.
Let me expound on that. Right? On my maternal side. Yeah, my maternal side, through what they told me orally, I was able to go and look up some records, right? The records that I looked up, I found my grandfather within one of the tribal roles in Florida. Now, his family in particular that's still there on a reservation in Florida, their last name has a Spanish-sounding surname, right? Otero. They're part of the Seminole tribe. Now, when I look further into the history of that family, they're actually descended from Spanish and Moroccans who came over with the conquistadors that set up camp in Florida at the time of Ponce de Leon and the guys who came over to Florida. But that particular segment of that family who came over, they actually went against the Spaniards, and then they mixed in with the native people that was already there. When you say to look further, right, about the Middle Passage, in my own research, the Middle Passage isn't what people have said it's to be. In my research, and I could be wrong, but the research that I've done says that the number of people that they say came over, which they say was in the millions, is actually impossible with the technology at the time coming over on sailboats.
Hold on for a second. Yeah. That's not the conversation. This always happens when I try to have this conversation. That's not the conversation I'm having. I'm not getting into a dispute on the numbers, how many. I'm simply, when I asked you that question, I did that for a reason, to clear and expose this genocide problem. Okay? So when I asked you the question directly, right, it was challenging. Let's just keep it real. It was challenging for you to give a simple answer back. If somebody asked me, I can say very quickly, resoundingly, and definitively, yes. And then I can tell you who, and then I can give you the details. And I think you implicitly recognized you have a narrative, but you don't know for sure. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's why I asked the – right. So that is – what I'm trying to demonstrate to people is we still have this problem where we don't actually know. And what we're doing is we're taking the best information that we have, which is all I'm doing now. I'm saying, hey, I've got better information now because I have better tools. It may be true, it may not be true. But then when you go and you do further research, I was actually able to say, okay, based on this narrative theory that I have, now I can actually prove.
Well, see,
a lot
whole
of
point,
people want to be able to do that.
Okay, we're going to yield the floor back to Dr. Winters.
Okay, the proof is in the pudding, so to say. The whole point is this: is that I know one of my ancestors came across the Middle Passage. But see, the one thing
where did they come from?
Looking at, where do they come from? I don't know. Somewhere in Africa, but what does it matter? It doesn't matter. I know that he was African. I know that on my mother's side, they were Choctaw.
Wait a minute.
My mother.
Dr. Winters, I got you right there. I got you right there.
You won't let me finish.
I got you right there.
You won't let me finish.
Because you're going to skip over the most important point, which is where they came from.
You said they survived the Middle Passage,
but you don't know where. You don't know where they came from, what language they spoke. And I just want to ask you directly, do you do that?
This is it. The whole point is that. I base my origins on two things, genealogy with my father's side of family and oral tradition. You see, the whole point is that. You know, the white man, he's white and I say so. He said you're a nigger. He said that everybody was a slave. Granted, that's what he believes. But I know what my mother and grandmother and them taught me. Therefore, in a sense, I know my background. I know where my homeland is. My homeland is down in Mississippi. I live in Chicago, and I like it up here. Therefore, in a sense, I don't care about I don't care about Africa. I love Africa.
Well, there
I'm
you go.
Pan-Africanist.
Okay.
Let me finish. I love Africa. I'm a Pan-Africanist. But when it comes down to it, as a foundational black American, this is my land. American culture is nothing but black culture.
I'm not talking about politics right now.
No, you won't let me finish. I'll let you talk.
I'm not talking about politics.
I know the culture. Yeah, I may not know the specific language that I spoke in Africa, and that's wonderful. You know why it's wonderful? It's wonderful because I can say I'm part of every African nation that exists on the continent in terms of my ancestry. But you know what? That's my ancestry. My heritage is America. My heritage is a nigger and an injured. You see, that's my heritage. I'm proud of that. I'm very proud of it. I'll admit, when I was growing up and my mother used to talk that stuff, I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to hear it because I looked at those cowboy movies and the Indians always lost, and I didn't want to be a loser. But see, now I know. You talked about us being a human and inhuman treatment. You talked about us being made servile. I'm a foundational black American. Foundational black Americans have never been servile. We fought 250. They only teach you about three. Slave rebellion. There was 250 slave rebellions. That's not even talking about the Gucci War. No, we are a strong people. We are a valiant people. We're not a people of cowards. We're not a people of cowards. Yes, we were enslaved on that plantation. We went along to get along. When people had the opportunity, they ran away. Most of our people stayed on plantations. But see, you forget, on those plantations, there was not just Africans. They also had stolen Indians who were also enslaved. In fact, most of the slaves When black people came over, it was Indians, and the white man, anytime he wanted to, he go pick up a black slave and say, "You a nigger. Now get over there, Indian." They didn't never want to recognize us. See, and so then therefore, I don't have to prove anything to anybody. The white man, he proves it by giving a white card. You got to see the paper from African ancestry? Beautiful. I love it. But you know what? I'm going to have what my mommy told me. You see, my mama didn't have to lie. My grandma didn't have to lie. See, I'm going off my oral traditions. I know who I am. And I've done the research to support it. Okay, and so then therefore, since I've done the research, I'm not worried about what African tribe my great-great-great-great-granddaddy came from. You see? Mm-hmm. Not worried about that. But I do know on that plantation they had some Choctaw and they had some Cree. See? See?
And
the whole point is this
Dr.
is that
Winters,
we go ahead.
Dr. Winters, and I really appreciate the way that you broke down, and Brother Issa broke down the, you know, the reliability of genetics, because, and to the audience, because, you know, most of our people, they're not college educated, so they will jump on the bandwagon, and literally, you know, next thing you know, you'll see people running to Africa and this, that, and the other instead of securing their rights right here. And
right,
one of my biggest concerns is with that approach. Number one, the science of genetics is shaky. I have a Master of Science in Criminal Justice, and I was exposed to genetics, you know, and exposed to forensic science. So that's why I knew that there was a margin of error with genetic testing. Number two, and from the criminology perspective. And also, just based on the conversation both you and Brother Seafway have had, it's from the ancestry testing perspective as well. So we have too much riding right now in this hour as a people to base and make a political decision that we have to make on self-determination based on something that is can be weaponized against us if we co-sign on testing as the basis of our identity. With concern with the heritage sites and the domestic remedies, I'm very familiar with some of the things that the Gullah Geechee has gotten. The Gullah Geechee has to go before Congress to even be recognized so often. That's against international law. On the face, after slavery, we were treated similar to the Native Americans, but all of those gains were rescinded because they wanted to, off our backs, rebuild after they destroyed the United States after the Civil War. They utilized our wealth, our resources, our human capital to rebuild themselves after the war, to rebuild the enslavers, and to give them reparations, but left us out hanging to dry. But now we're supposed to take an ancestry test and circumvent our immediate reparations and redress that we are entitled to right now. I don't think that's very wise. And
that's
with that,
true, because
I guess,
see, and see, but I'm, and that's so true, because whenever you want to go with the why didn't I say so, whenever you want to go that why didn't I say so, they're going to bring up two things. Do you have a card I gave you, gave the Indians? Oh, well, you're not one. Did we make a treaty with you? Oh, we're not one. They took Martha Vineyard from black Indians. They took it.
That's right.
They took Central Park. And they took that. They didn't make a treaty. They just said, nigga, get your ass off the damn cut. Get out of here. And that's a beautiful
and it's
park.
Still doing.
Have you seen pictures? Have you seen pictures of how beautiful their city was, and they tore it down? They just had a thing last week with this guy in California. They took his land. The white man always been taking our land. Well, now you can't go off that white and not say so. You can't go off that white and not say so. Look at those black people who went out and protested. They wanted to change police laws. You see, all these people come from all over the damn world. They run from their country. We don't run. We stay and we fight. You see, I am a foundational black American. My heritage is Indian and African. My ancestry is all African, baby, maybe. We all came from Africa. But I tell you, this is that you owe me something, and I want a check.
That's right.
I want a check.
That's right. That's right.
Talking about whatever
the
hell I want with a check.
That's right. That's right. And you know what, Dr. Winters, I'm going to tell you something. But before I do, I'm going to bring in some of our callers. Sister Candida, are you on the line? Sister Lily, are you on the line?
Yes, sister. This is Candida. I'm on the line.
Okay. I'm going to bring in some more of our callers.
Yes, sister. Sister Lane, this is Sister Lily. I'm on the line, and I'm very happy to be listening to this exchange.
Wonderful, wonderful. Is there anything you would like to say to Dr. Winters while we have him on?
Well, I for one, this is Sister Lily, and I'm gonna say this out loud. I for one am so proud that someone like Dr. Winters is out there with the information and research and to set the record straight when people come in and try to tell us to just listen to American or Western pedagogy and science. When Western pedagogy and science has betrayed the indigenous people since its inception, and that is my belief system. I know my indigenous roots. I know that my people were given the Coushatta Nation in Louisiana. And so I know who we are, and whether or not the Dawes list will acknowledge us or not, whether or not we're allowed to join the Dawes list because for whatever reason we were reclassified as Negro since Governor Plecker in Virginia. You know, the lies, and when you take your DNA, I just had a relative take the DNA test, and none of those indigenous roots showed up on her DNA test. So I don't trust it. Now, that's what I'd like to say about that.
Exactly, exactly. And I look at it like this. Why would I make myself an immigrant when we know for a fact we were already here? The majority of us are already here. We have political interests, and this is another thing. We're going to have to do a legal and a political partition with these expatriate Africans because the way we are right now, we're no more than a loose mob. That's all we are. And they can come in and usurp our identity and access resources and do whatever they want to with it. We don't have that relationship with an African country yet that will allow us to expand to Africa where we can reap the gains here and they can reap the gains there. We have to organize ourselves. We are already a declared nation. There's paperwork that has already been submitted. We've done a very good job in building that case from a nationhood perspective. Now, for those people who want to, tribalize and find out who their African ancestors and maybe repatriate, because I do see Brother Sipaway's information and the way that he's addressing his family genealogy and what he wants to do. That's great for those people who want to repatriate back to Africa. But for those of us who are in the nation-building camp and about securing our rights here first for our generations to come, and it's not just about ADOS or Foundation or Africa. It's about common sense and self-preservation. We've
That's
already
right.
been manipulated for over 500 years politically. Okay? We were manipulated after 1865, and we're being manipulated politically right now. Look at all the gains and legislation that's being put out there for the Asians, the helpless Asians.
Yeah.
We've been murdered in droves for decades. Where's our legislation? Okay?
Right.
We're still being gunned down the street.
Sister Elaine, I'd like to ask a question.
Yes.
This is Candida. I'm all in agreement concerning our rights here and securing our land. You know, we've talked about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are we going to use to prove that we're indigenous to here? Because we are
seeking
reparations.
You don't have to use anything. The law says you are who you say you are. The ILO 169 agreement, paragraph 1, section paragraph 1, it says you are who you self-identify. Indigenous is a status. That's a status. One of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights states, you are who you say you are. The United States didn't have a right to label us in the first place. And
that's
why
right.
justify what they did to us with their DNA test? That's anti-ethical to what we want to do. I mean, it's really, it's what I'm trying to say to you is we have international laws that the Afro descendants have used in Latin America, the indigenous people have used in Latin America to secure our rights right now. All it takes is a declaration and keep it moving. Now, if you want to know who your family members are, where they came from, and, you know, and tie yourself back to Africa, maybe there's some benefits there. Maybe it isn't. We don't know. But what we have to do in this hour, because we're in a political configuration that's genocidal, and we're going to hand this genocidal configuration right on to the next generation. If we don't do something now and focus on what we have to do now politically to secure land rights, our property rights, and when I say property, I'm talking about biological property. I'm looking at how can we use genetic to secure our rights, our genetic makeup right now, and possibly copyright it, because our genetics is tied to our culture, to our intellectual property that's being given away. We got patents right now that was in the 1800s because our ancestors were enslaved. Their slave masters benefited from it.
That's
how can we use this genetic testing to secure what we got right here, right now? That's what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in nothing.
Sister Elena, that is the point that I'm trying to make, because the American Indians really got a lot of our benefits. They got benefits that were supposed to be ours. And so, you know, those, you know, they were really perpetrating a fraud. You know, indigenous means first. And our people were the first here. The Mongolian ancestry of the American Indian, they didn't come until much later. So what I'm asking is, yes, I can say, I know that part that says I am who I say I am as far as it goes how our oppressor named us to suit his whatever his agenda was at the time. Will that still hold up, my question? Will that still hold up? I am who I say I am when it comes to securing the land back.
Internationally, it will. Internationally, it will. But Brother Seif, let me explain, Dr. Winters, about this legal strategy. And it's what the Gullah Geechee used. Most of the Gullah Geechee's land in those corridors, that's federal land. You got Gullah Geechee right here in Georgia. Can't even go fish without being locked up. I have a friend that went to the University of Georgia. She did a documentary on the Gullah Geechee's in Georgia. The rights that were secured are not uniform. Number two, there's a time limit on their recognition. According to international human rights law, you are who you say you are, whether it's 100 years later, 5 years later, Congress don't get to dictate and put a time limit on your identity. So that's the flaw. And that's how the United States keep their illegal, absolute plenary power over all of their encapsulated, colonized people. And its genetic testing is only one slick, sly way of us circumventing the issue, putting ourselves back in this jurisdiction where we can continue to be legally and politically enslaved. And Dr. Winters, I yield the floor back to you.
Okay, and then secondly, you got not only I say so. You say, yes, we're going off oral tradition. but also you have to bring up culture. See, the white man has lied to you. The white man lied to you and said you don't have a culture. The white man lied to you and said that your culture was stolen. Your ethnicity was stolen. That's a lie. We do have a culture. You see? In fact, American culture is our culture. I'll give you an example. When I was growing up, my old man was from Mississippi. And he every weekend, and when it started in the spring, he'd go out and break some land out in the suburbs in Chicago. We'd go out there, and he would have us plant beans, corn, and squash. I hated squash, but, you know, Mama cooked it, so I ate it. But it was beans, corn, and squash, and some tomatoes. You see? That is the historical food indigenous people in this country. The white man grew wheat. You see? The Mongoloid Indians didn't grow shit. They were just some damn vagabonds who rode off us and sold us out. They took our history. They took everything. You see, I've been working on recovering the language. You see, because see, when you really look at it, just about all the rivers and place names end in ka, K A or C A. That's a Mandingo place name. You see, even in Oklahoma, they got a whole lot of cities in Oklahoma with those place names. You see. But the thing is, this is that when you don't know. To me, I started studying African history years ago. I had to learn six languages. I had to learn how to read Spanish. I already knew French. I had to learn how to read Tamil. That's an Indian language. I had to learn Mayan. I had to learn, in a sense, Chinese, because I wanted to find out our true history, you see? So, see, that's why the white man can't tell me nothing. If you say you're white and I say so, you're a lie. See, I'm going off what my mama taught me. Gates, Bill Gates up at Harvard, his parents and everybody told him he was Indian, but he said he wasn't Indian because he had the R haplogroup, and only Europeans have R haplogroup. That's a damn lie. The Belanta got R haplogroup. That some of the first slaves came here had R haplogroup. And the white man, he didn't rape every black person, you see? So that's a lie. They steal our culture because we let them. We have a culture. We have a culture. We did lose our culture. We did lose our culture because the white man, remember, he didn't want us to hardly speak out his language. Yeah, we talk that mush mouth mess around them. You don't see black people talking that mess now. See? Mm-hmm. Know who you are. Know who your culture is. I think you're doing a great job, Mr. Sipaway. You're doing a great thing for those people who want to go to Africa. It's the greatest thing on earth, and I really hope, you know, they enjoy themselves and go back. But, hey, this is my land, baby. I might die, but I told my kids, you better fight for this land because we're foundational black Americans. You see? We call ourselves foundational black Americans. Why? Because we don't want these immigrants taking our mess. We already had the Mongoloid Indians. They was our so-called friends. You see what happened to us. Mm-hmm. All the money they're making today off of our name. So we don't need no allies. We're foundational black Americans. Mm-hmm. We're not African Americans.
Mm-hmm. And the strategy.
Also, I want to add one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
Claude Anderson, remember, Claude Anderson has been in court for years trying to make them pay us off that 1866 treaty, which guaranteed all former slaves, you know, cash money. Plus, they stole all the money from the Freeman banks. They stole all that money. They've been robbing us. They've been robbing us blind. They took our land, they took our money, and then took our identity. But I'm taking it back.
And Dr. Winters, to piggyback off of that. As far as I'm concerned, and I've spoken with some people in the Inter-American court system in the OAS, we've exhausted all remedies judicially. We can prove that beyond a shadow of a doubt. Our next step, it appears to be, is to go to Congress and get some proceedings there. Give them so many days to answer and to address our grievances, and we keep it pushing it and take them to the international jurisdiction because we have a greater gamut of protections based on our identity of who we are. These people already know who we are, but the person don't know. The average person don't know. So what has to be done is those of us who do, we need to keep pushing on. I respect Brother Safiwe's work, and I would hope that he would continue on with what he's doing. And I invite people and encourage people who wish to repatriate back to Africa to join him in that fight. But for us who is in the fight right now, who is trying to secure land rights right now and recover some of the misplaced and the misappropriated assets that we've lost due to the slave trade, due to the recolonization after World War II, and even right now we're being recolonized as we speak. Land is being taken from us right now as we speak, and we're 50 million strong almost, and we don't have anybody type of representation. So the only other avenue that we have is to go into nationhood and to operate as a collective and secure our collective property and collective property rights. If we try to, go in individually and reclaim this and that and establish yourself as this tribe, that tribe, all that do is fragments us as a people, and we're going to be another 150 years trying to do what it is that was supposed to have been done in the 1960s. We need to operate from a nation perspective. For those who want to tribalize themselves and want to work individually, they have that opportunity too. But I don't see it as being beneficial right now. Right now, we need to secure those collective rights that are available to us. And we have the proof by the cases, the reparation cases, the land right cases right there in the OAS. So I do believe his work has a place with the African descendant nation, but the urgency requires us to move legally and politically. You know, I am who I say I am in the discussion, and we need our land back. And with that, I yield the floor.
Yeah, I'd like to add on.
This is Candida. I'd just like to piggyback off of Sister Elena, what you were saying. We're so far behind economically. This is the only way as a people that we are going to catch up and even surpass economically is once we nationalize, then we can practice group economics. But just individually, no. We're just going to be in the same boat. This is the only way for us to do it, and it is pertinent that our people get that understanding.
Yeah,
and
this
to
is
that, I yield the floor.
I want to add on to the conversation. One of the things when we're talking about indigenous to this country, you got to understand before the United States was established in 1776, anybody who was here before that republic was established, if your ancestors were already here, you're indigenous to this land. So you don't have to go by being part of any tribe that they say is federally recognized. If your family was here before the establishment of this country, then you're indigenous to this land. And if you say that you're part of those people and your ancestors are related to those people, this is your
country. I know yesterday Mama had a whole bunch of movies on.
One of the other things. One of the other things is right now they're practicing apartheid in this country. You know what I mean? And the apartheid regime in South Africa, they laid the Europeans labeled everybody and said, "Well, this is your color, your South African black." They labeled everybody, and that's how they remained in power for so long. So one of the things you could do here, when you talk about buying power, black people do have economic buying power. They do have group economics, but they spend their money with the wrong people. They'll spend $200 to buy a pair of Jordans. And the Jordan company is a multi-billionaire company because of the spending power of over $1 trillion that black Americans have. So what happens is the money is there, right? It's just the focus that has to be there. And with the brother Sifu Way, I understand what he's saying, but one of the things is, after 1865, you have a new nation in this country. You know what I mean? You have a new nation of people that have to establish their nationhood. When we talk about international law, we have right now not only paper genocide that goes on, but we have actual genocide going on right now under color of law. When they have these race soldiers out there wearing police uniforms, systematically killing black people, right, that's genocide under color of law. And you can say it's a state sponsor of terrorism. You know what I mean? Because they're terrorizing black communities. So, right, I agree with Sister Elena. Right now, the primary opponents, we can have a plebiscite. People who want to repatriate back to Africa, okay, repatriate. People who want to stay in the current system jurisdiction, you can stay. But the people who want to go forth and have their own land and their own jurisdiction, they have the right to do that. And that's the move that everybody should be focusing on right now. Because since the 1960s, when Huey P. Newton and them, the Black Panthers talked about having a plebiscite. But what happened? They killed them off systematically, put them in prison for the rest of their life. Now, they're now POWs, basically, Dr. Matulu Shakur, and the rest of the political prisoners. And when we had so-called black president and leadership that was in power, they could do something, they didn't do anything. They forgot about them brothers. And South Africa, they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Desmond Tutu was on that, right? They were letting these genocidal maniacs loose if they confessed to their crimes, right? Because they said we have to have truth and reconciliation, right? We had a civil rights movement, right? And this is what a lot of people don't understand. The civil rights movement allowed the mass immigration to happen today. Because if it wasn't those put down their lives down there in Alabama, down there in Georgia, right, they were being lynched and they was fighting. If it wasn't for them, you wouldn't have mass immigration for any of these other countries except European countries.
That's
So when we talk about this situation right now, if mass action isn't taken right now and don't let the establishment and the gatekeepers control the narrative, right, if right now we don't do it, like Dr. went to say, the descendants of right now, your great-grandchildren, they're going to be in perpetual slavery. It's going to be by a different name, but it's going to be perpetual slavery.
That's right. And we're in it right now, Brother Ether. And we're in it right now, Brother Ether. Look at the mass incarceration. Look at the control. Now, everybody thinks we're going to get reparations based on what happened during the Atlantic slave trade. That's not necessarily true. We should be litigating on the fact of the matter that the United States government apartheid using colorblind language. Aspect, every institution has been weaponized against us. That's our argument.
And not only that, but see, people forget. The brother just brought up a very important fact, is that everybody before the founding of the nation, of the United States, or the 13 colonies, are indigenous. Let's not forget, they ended the Atlantic slave trade. The majority of black people in the United States today, especially Georgia, Mississippi, they were either slaves that were brought there before the revolution, or they were slaves that were sold from the north to the south. We are indigenous. That's no question. The only problem is that as long as we allow Europeans to have hegemony over our history, as long as we allow white people to say who we are because they're white and they say so, then that's how we lose. We were mainly here before the revolution. After the American government took over, they're the ones who declared us three-fourths a man. They're the ones who legalized the slave trade. They're the interstate slave trade. They're the ones who gave the states the right to dominate us and in a sense allowed them to destroy us. Yeah, then they gave us the 14th Amendment. That 14th Amendment, they owed us benefits. And then the Civil Rights Act of 1866, they owe us benefits. They didn't give us those benefits. They owe us money based on the law. The only problem is we don't want to take the law in our own hands. We're waiting for the white man to do it. And the white man is not going to help you because he lie about you.
That's why we got to get him out of his comfort zone, out of his jurisdiction, and pull him into the international jurisdiction where he don't have that many friends. That's my strategy, you know. As far as I'm concerned,
now, Elena,
exercise all
remedy.
Come on in, Seafway. Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Yeah, you had me on mute, so I just been listening. Now,
yeah,
I will forgive Dr. Winters because he's not familiar with my position or my work or where I stand politically. But you, Elena, you know. And
mm-hmm.
it's really troublesome the way you characterize some of the strategy that we've discussed at length. Everybody should know, first of all, when you characterize running back to Africa, but we are here in this fight here, that's really disingenuous. And people that are familiar with my political work will know that the basis of my political work is that there is strength in numbers. And one of the fundamental issues that our movement has suffered from before the Civil War, right, when you had Walker and Delaney and Douglas, all of which had different strategies fighting amongst themselves, or when it reappeared after in the 60s when you had different factions, right? The bottom line is, at the moment of our emancipation, right, when we became free persons without the status of citizenship, that
mm-hmm.
14th Amendment was an offer of citizenship. It didn't make us citizens. And the law says that at that time, as free persons with the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the key word being liberty, means that each of us had the right to determine our own political, economic, social, and cultural associations going forward. And there were only four natural choices. They existed then, and they exist now, and it's covered by the whole plebiscite concept. You can either choose to return to your ancestral homeland. That is your right. You can stay in America and integrate and pursue integration as a citizen. That is your right. You could emigrate to a third-party country if they were willing to accept you. That is your right. And you could choose to form a nation of your own. That is your right. And the mistake that we have made consistently is that we don't
Brother Seafway?
Yes,
Brother
which
Seafway?
One of those four options? Yes.
Okay, I was just wanting to make sure you were still on.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you
Hello?
Now, but it went out.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. What I was saying is the same problem that existed before the Civil War, right after emancipation and up today, is that we have these four options. Again, return to your ancestral homeland, stay and try to integrate into America, emigrate to a third-party country, right, or four, establish a new nation of your own. And the mistake we have always made in the past is that we don't respect each other's right to determine which one of those four options is best. And so what we do is the repatriation is end up fighting with the nationalists who end up fighting with the integrationists, right? And the one thing that we have to do is the only thing that we can unite under, and you have to unite because we have to develop the compelling force sufficient, right, to overcome our oppressor's force. And so there's strength in numbers. And so until we respect each other's right to determine and don't sell each other out and say it's all or nothing, self-determination or nothing, and we don't pit the nationalists against the repatriationists, against the integrationists, and respect everybody's right, that's what self-determination fundamentally means.
I agree with that.
Your birthright, can we, right, I'm sure we all agree.
But let me address the previous conversation, Brother Seafway. Let me address when you first came on. You said I misrepresented your position. Your work is beneficial to those who wish to repatriate.
Yeah, I heard that.
But I'm
interested in
utilize genetics to secure our property rights, our cultural rights, and our biological rights right here. So I've made my
position
clear.
And that's why, let me respond to that. That's exactly why I said you misrepresented it, because you have read my agenda for Black America's restoration and self-determination, and you know that repatriation is just one element of the comprehensive vision that we have put forward. And so you know that I'm doing work, right, to use the genetic arguments, right, both for the actual repair of people here and in international law, so that we can secure all four of those things. So the nationalists, right, can establish their nation and get it recognized in international law, and the repatriationists can be able to return to their ancestral homeland, which is their birthright, right? And that the people that want to stay here and exercise their full rights, right, as American citizens, can do that if they choose. So that's why I say you misrepresented my work and my position, and you pigeonholed it into the one hole of repatriation, where my work in genetics and international law is way more comprehensive than that, and I'm making an argument for all of our people.
Well, from what I see, I don't see how, because legally and politically it fragments us if we base our identity on shaky genetics. And that's my position, and I'm not changing.
I didn't.
Genetics
I didn't
is shaky. Genetics is shaky anyway.
Elena. First of all, I've already shown in my personal case that it's not shaky. And second of all, I'm not saying that that's the only strategy. We've discussed this before, and there are many theaters of struggle, many battlefronts, and we have a new tool that other people are using. White people do not have a monopoly on understanding the universal laws and principles that govern reproduction and genetics. Those universal laws and principles can be mastered by people of any nation and race. And so either we start mastering it and using that tool, right, for ourselves and using it as a weapon where we can or we don't. Imagine if our ancestors said, oh, we're not going to use fire because you could get burned with it. No, when we discovered fire, we used it. Yes, it's a tool. No one is presenting this as the end-all, be-all solution. What we have put forward is said, it is now 2021. It's not 1960. It's not 1860. Okay? And so there are new pathways because of genetics. And second of all, you keep using the word tribalistic, right? And that's sort of demeaning and just
I don't think so at all, because number one,
okay, well, good,
we've grown to become a distinct population right now. Our genetics, yeah, we may have left Africa one tribe, but when we got here we became something else, because we were forced to procreate amongst each other. I mean, there's counties here in Georgia where just people are inbred. So we became a distinct people. We were raped. We've been maimed. Due to the fact of the oppression and everything that we've went through, we're not the same people. So my position
is, this is exactly the argument.
Use genetics to secure who we are right now. Can't we use genetics to secure who we are right now?
It's not either or, it's and both. And you're making my case for me. All that brutality and rape and the fact that you said that we've become something else is the fact or the result of the crime. And that damage is real, and that's exactly what we're trying to repair. Repair to what? What were we like before all of the trauma? What was in our DNA before? Now we can start to have a standard to answer the question, well, repair to what? What was the condition before the crime? Now, the crime of ethnocide is every bit as powerful as the crime of genocide. Genocide is the destruction of a people physically. Ethnocide is the destruction of a people's identity while keeping them alive. So now we are able to use international law that relates specifically to the crime of ethnocide, if you can say, this is what my ethnicity is, and I take exception to the statement, you are who you say you are. Well, then that means white people who say they're Afro-descendants are Afro-descendants. You are not who you say you are. You are the unity of your mother and father. That's who you are. You are your mother and father, right, reproduced as one, which means you are also, right, their mother and father, and so on. You are actually your ancestors. And the question has to be asked, right, the brother had brought this up. When you put forward all of these different histories, you still have to answer the question, is that your history? Germans do not claim the same histories, certain groups in Germany. Anglo-Saxons are not the same as some the Huguenots or whatever, right? They embrace their culture, their collective European, but they teach their actual histories. And we're trying to repair that damage. There was trauma. My history does not start with the slavery time. My history goes back before 1760, before 1500s, before 1300s. And so truth will set you free. Truth will set you free. Your best standing in any court, domestic or international, is not what you say. It's what's true. And sometimes, believe it or not, our oral history passed down to us.
These Europeans didn't have no genetic tests when they enslaved us, and they don't have genetic tests when they're going around killing us. So why should we have to have it now to secure our right to self-determination?
Nobody said you have to have it.
And immediate reparations.
It's a choice to you. You don't have to. It's saying that it's a tool that some of us can use to win. And we talked about this before, the fears about, you know, ceding territory on other battlefronts. We've already addressed that. And you already agreed that a lot of that is knee-jerk reaction because people who aren't really listening and studying the work that we've put out, which we really didn't get a chance to go into deeply on this call, right? People, they have their ideas of what they think it is. And they turn, even on this call, we did a lot of people, you know, just trying to defend their position instead of really trying to learn from each other. Because I'm not in opposition to the standard foundational Black American or ADOS because I am foundational Black. I'm the eighth generation, right, of my family in America. And so, yes, if I want to claim everything is in the land of my captivity where I'm a prisoner of war, if I want to claim those things, I have every right to do that. But I'm not going to also at the same time say that right now in this time, right, my family that's on the other side of the Atlantic and my land and my territory that I have just as much claim to, right, that's not important. It's not an either or. It's both and all. And we need to learn that and stop pitting each other against each other. I support the Aboriginal
Brother Seifway, I respect your work, and you know we even had it. We spoke at length last week, and I do feel there's a place for it, and we do, and there's a place for genetics, but in this hour, in this time, right now, I think, and this is my humble
opinion,
it's
even more important.
I think it's important, but I think it could be a stalemate. Genetics can be weaponized. The European has weaponized every aspect of science against us every time that we try to use it. And we just don't have the time nor the resources. And this is just based on my work where I know we are right now and what we're up against right now. We don't have the resources nor the time to apply genetics to this fight we have now. If we don't move on self-determination and nationhood and nation building and changing even the language of our politics, we're going to hand this next generation genocide. I mean,
right.
Flat out genocide. Wait a minute.
Genetics is not outside of that.
Wait a minute. These are the times that we're in. I'm not saying your work is invaluable, that we can't use it. But what I'm saying is, we have to do what we need to do right now. Everyone's not interested, even me. You know, and I've done my research. I have had contacts with Africans. I know our history, you know, when it comes to Africa. And I've been on the phone with Africans. I conversate with them. They're not romanticizing us the way that we're romanticizing them, and that's a flaw. And to tie our political and our economic base to them in the state that they're in and that they've allowed Africa to be in is suicide twice on our end.
Then you fundamentally don't understand because we're not romanticized. I don't, when you say we are romanticized, I don't know who you're referring to.
No, certainly not me. I'm saying you have a lot of people that romanticize Africa. We cannot tie our politics with theirs. We cannot tie what we have going on right here in the United States is totally different from what they have going on in Africa.
It was precisely our great foundational black Americans like Malcolm X, Huey Newton, and others that said, no, as a matter of fact, we have to internationalize our struggle. And if we are naive to think global geopolitics.
From a state-to-state perspective, it'll benefit us, but not on an individual level, it won't.
So what do you nation building is? Doesn't right. Recognize with that, you know, I have to go. You know, I have another call. So I was thankful that I could at least get a chance to respond because I was kind of left out of the conversation from the beginning. I didn't want it to become adversarial, right?
We have to have these conversations.
But it has
We're family.
Yeah,
we have to have these hard conversations, whether we like them or not. They have to be had.
Agreed.
Because even though, you know, we have these, you know, these ideas and these dreams of working with Africa and rebuilding Africa, we need to secure our rights right here so we can have the resources to carry those things out. But we have to distinguish
ourselves. Well, when you say secure our rights right here,
from the expat,
right here to me means on Earth, wherever
we are.
No, I mean
right here in the United States. That's what I'm concerned about. Right here, what's up under my feet. That's what I want to secure right now.
I agree, but that's if you think that that's your only birthright, then they really have really done a job on you.
No, they haven't done a job on me. I'm just strategic. I want to secure what's right here, right now. I get to
You're
Haiti
not the only one that's strategic.
I get to Haiti before I get to Africa, so I can see myself spending a couple of dollars to buy some land there. But
I'm going to end with this. Hold on. I'm going to end with this. My father told me if you want to solve a problem, you got to go to the origin of the problem. For me and for many foundational black Americans, the origin of the problem started when the crime was that one of your ancestors was captured and trafficked and brought here as a prisoner of war. That means the original crime happened for many of us on the African continent. So any solution, like not a partial Band-Aid, but an actual solution and final repair and justice, by definition, has to extend all the way to the origin of the problem. And that origin of the problem is for those that were brought here against their will as prisoners of war, that ultimately has to be incorporated.
But what about the ones that were enslaved right here that are prisoners of war?
Exactly. So the question is how do you know which camp you fall into?
But see, that's the whole point. We don't have to fall
now,
into a camp.
I got to start my
We don't have to fall into a camp. The camp that we fall
exactly.
in is the camp that's logical. And see, the most important thing to remember is that. What you forget, Seaway, is that we did have a history here before the white man came. We did build
Some
great civilizations
did.
In
my
North America
did.
Before the white man came. And therefore, you're making this blanket statement
as if it covers everybody.
It does cover everybody. I'm going to tell you why it covers everybody.
It doesn't cover me.
It does cover you too.
My family history, you won't let me finish.
The reason it covers you is that your black ancestors on that plantation, some of them made it with indigenous foundational black Americans. See, the whole point of this is that we're not just one people. as Elena said earlier, we're not just one people. See, we're a mix. That's why we're Foundation Black Americans. We're a mixture of the indigenous and the African. And the point is this.
Agreed.
That we did have a history. We had a history before the white man got here. He just changed it. And the only point, that's why I wrote, we are not just
African. You
haven't
changed mine.
In that book, I explained we had a history here. I don't have to go to Africa. I love African history. I've written books on African history. I've written books on the history of blacks in India. I know my history, but the most important thing is that Africa is my ancestry, my heritage. My heritage is here.
Exactly.
Mississippi,
well,
Chicago.
Let me add on that, right? Africa is your heritage.
It's not my heritage.
We have rights on your ancestors are your heritage, and I'm saying, right, our heritage is on both sides of the Atlantic. Unfortunately, I got to go because I host another meeting at 6 o'clock.
Okay,
right?
Okay,
Dr. Winters, right, I would like to discuss with you more, right, more about the relationship between linguistics and genetic encoding. I would love to have that kind of discussion with you sometime in the future.
Okay.
Wate Sim, my native language.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Winters, for explaining genetics and going into depth with genetics on this particular show because, again, I'm well-versed in genetics when it comes to the criminology part and familiar with the flaws there. But when it comes to the perspective of populations and testing for populations, I'm not well versed in that. I have one other question for you, Dr. Winters. Will you go into a discussion and tell us about the identity of who was the Paleo American?
Okay. The Paleo Americans. They were the first people to come here. The Paleo-Americans, the research shows that they were of the Australian, Melanesian, or African type. We know that they couldn't have come from Melanesia or Australia because of the fact that the Ice Age blocked Asia off from the United States. So they only had to come from one place, Africa. This Professor Guinan down in Brazil, she said that the first people in the Americas were Africans. Okay, as I was talking earlier about Anzac man, they've done some type of genetic study. But see, as I said before, what the white man does is that he changes the names of haplogroups. He changes the names so you can't put them together. And if you don't do original research, you won't see the significance of it, just like I told you. I sent an article off, and I said it was no M1 Native Americans today. And then they wrote me back and said, you're mistaken. A, B, C, D, those are all M1. What? See, the white man, he knows what he's teaching you in these schools. He knows the lies he's teaching you, but you don't know the lies. And unless you do real good research, you won't find out. So the Paleo-Americans were black people. They do not find any skeletons of Mongoloid Indians until 6,000 years ago. That's 4,000 BC. I mean, 2,000 BC. But black people have been here since 100,000 years ago. But see, what happens is that it was different black people at different times. But the most important thing to understand is that we have a dual culture. We got a culture.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't grow up in the South. I grew up in the North. So I only got pieces of it. But I mean, down South, everybody know how to hunt. Everybody know how to clean animals. Everybody know how to farm.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't grow up in no family without your mama or grandmama, somebody teaching you how to grow something. See?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as these black people got up here, they tried to find it. Once they bought their own home, they started trying to farm. We got a culture. And see, the point is this is that, as the brother tried to bring up earlier, they're just taking your money, $300, $400, $500. I can tell you whatever I want to tell you. And if you believe it, fine. But see, you're still going off the white man. I don't have to go off the white man. I do research myself. And I do the citations myself. So then therefore, I'm not going to wait for you to tell me something. You don't like me. They like Africans. Mm-hmm. They like Caribbean, but they don't like foundationally black Americans because they know this is our land. They know if we didn't have faith in a creator, they know they would have been wiped out long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
See, we had to go back to this. See, he was talking about citizenship. Remember, the 14th Amendment gave us citizenship. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 guaranteed us money. And so then that means in a sense that when they put us in the Jim Crow, you know, like my daddy fought in World War II. He couldn't get a damn house, but they let white people get the houses.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't get a house. He couldn't get a house until the 1970s. The white people got them right after they came back from the war. They did, you know, you can go to Barber College, but they wouldn't go to this college. No, they've been taking away our benefits. They owe us money. The only reason I talk about a check all the time is that if you got a check, you can buy the land. See?
That's right.
We don't want to be, excuse me, most of our rights are out of Georgia. So if it's any state we take, we want Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
We want Georgia. I don't want no other damn state. You want to be near the sea so you can trade. See?
Mm-hmm.
You see? But the whole point is this is that. That genetic stuff is fine. But as you know, in a sense, from that criminology and forensic DNA, that stuff can prove it's individual people. But when you start talking about populations, and come on now, that's get out of here.
It is. And I look at it, Dr. Winters, and I don't know why he said that I misrepresented his stance, because he made his stance perfectly clear every time he opened his mouth it's beneficial. You know, his work is beneficial to people who wish to establish ties with Africa. I do believe we need to establish ties with African nations, but I think we need to do it from a place of power. Right now, we're not ready to have that conversation. Each black American family need to be using their identity to secure property rights, immediate reparations, not this window dressing where they're trying to give up $25,000 up in Ellen, Illinois. What can you do with that?
They don't give it to you, it's a loan.
That's right.
It's a loan.
And you got Negroes that's out here actually fighting for this and calling themselves some freedom fighters. Well, excuse me, I will pass in Cobra. I'll pass on everything that they've done in terms of reparations. It's done nothing. It's doing nothing.
I'm sorry. My background is so different. You see, you know, other people, their family were preachers. They had money, their relatives had money, so they were successful. My daddy had a fourth grade education, but I was able to go to college and university. My father was always there for us. My mother, they tried to raise me. My father tried to teach me to be a man, but my father taught me that, boy, you better always stand up for yourself and your family. You see?
That's right.
You don't have to go fight nobody. But see, when somebody tells me that we were so dehumanized that we can't fight, look at those young people over the summer. Standing up in front of guns.
That's right. That's right. And wait a minute, Dr. Winters. Look at over the summer how our militias popped up. Look at the black militias, how they stood up to the killing and to the murders.
But see, that militia, the leader of that militia used to be Donald Trump's bodyguard.
So then
that means that they're suspect. Any, I hate to say this, and if they do it to me, then hey, forget about it. But anytime the white man play up anybody or anything, most of the time it's not for us. I'm sorry.
Now, Dr. Winters, he wasn't there. He wasn't Donald Trump's bodyguard. He ran for he actually ran for president. That brother ran for president in 2016.
Yeah, but Tariq Nasheed sold a film where he was trying to protect Trump in one of the meetings.
You interpreted that as him protecting Trump? I thought he was just looking around.
No, he had got up and they went in the back. But you know, I mean, it's all good in the hood. But I mean, the thing is have you ever seen the white man? Did the white man support the Black Panthers? They had guns. They never liked a nigga with guns. Come on now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
So then, but But I don't care. I don't care. I'm old now. And as I said, I'm old, but I want my kids to keep fighting, you see? I want my kids to keep fighting. I don't have time for this. I love Africa. Africa's wonderful. But that ain't my heritage.
That's,
you know,
right.
People are asking us, Ilana. They're asking us to give up our heritage. My mama and grandma, they wasn't lying to me. Don't ever call him a lie, see? But you're telling me that what they tell me about my Indian heritage, indigenous heritage, is a lie. I say no. Why did they have to lie? Why did they great grandmas lie to them? Mm-hmm. They knew who the hell we were. So I don't have to wait for the white man to tell me who the hell I am. I know who I am.
That's right. That's right. We've been waiting on them too long anyway.
That's right. We're always letting them define who the hell we are. Get out of here. You know?
Thank you.
I mean, I didn't vote for Biden, but look at him. He said he couldn't give us nothing, but look at what he's given to Asia. Look at what he's given to any damn body. Look at what he's given those immigrants. Look at New York. New York has given $15 million to illegal aliens.
$15 million.
And what are we getting? Some of us got the stimmy. The stimulus check. But they're giving $15 million to illegal aliens. You know, like they put these illegal aliens all across the United States, down south, everywhere, so they can try to dilute our voting power. But they don't dilute our voting power. You know why? Because they think they white vote Republican anyway.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
they bring
true.
Them here. But the most important thing is that, you know, we do have a history. We have a history here. And it's not a history of slavery. See, anybody who just want to have slavery as their history, that's fine. But we had a history before then. But you cannot deny that over the years they took our land away from us and never gave a treaty, never said none, just said, nigga, move.
That's right.
Nigga, move. That's all they said. Get out of here, nigga. You color. You know, look at what they did in Virginia. Changed all those damn records. Get out of here.
And burned up the courthouses in the 90s. You saw a whole lot of courthouses going up in smoke. When people start looking for land patents and researching land in different states, especially here in the South, you know. And the sad part about it is we're in such a political stalemate that anything new, such as genetics, our people are taking it and run with it when we don't have to go through all that. So that was my reason for having the show and bringing you on as one of my experts, because I know your work is lock solid. Now, I may not know a lot about ancestry as it pertains to populations, but I knew you did, and that's why I reached out to you.
But another thing is that we're so ready to sell out. You know, we're so ready to sell out. You know what I'm saying? You know, you can be one first, black first. You see, you don't have to sell out, but see, you get into this fantasy world and you want to talk all this high and mighty stuff. Come on now, be for real. Come on down and talk to the people the way we talk. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. That's right.
You know?
Right. And the average John Doe, Dr. Winters, they're worried about how they're going to make it right now. You know, them stimulus checks, they gone. So we need reparations immediately. You know, we're on life support. We can't afford another 5 years in the same political situation we're in. We have political prisoners that have been rotting since the 1950s. We have areas that are still being gentrified. We have homeless populations that's terrible. We got violence that's being committed against us. Right out there in the open that nobody's doing anything about. The UN should have been over here. You know, the United Nations should have been over here. Our leadership, because they don't know international human rights law, they're selling us out. And they look, because they're up front and center, it looks like we're content. It looks like we're happy with our lot over here.
That's right.
So we have to build a nation. We have to secure our rights.
Right.
Using our identity. And the only way I see out is a unified African descended nation. That's the only way we're going to be able to move.
And that's why it's wonderful that Biden is in there doing these things, because Biden, see, they're going to need black people votes in 2022, but a lot of them might not be ready to vote Democratic when they see they didn't get enough. You know what I'm saying?
That's
so
true.
So everything is a growth process. And see, this is it. When I was in high school, I always wondered how did the compromise of 1874 go down, and then when I saw how Bush stole the election in 2000, oh, that's how it happened. See, history is just moving so quick. It's a reckoning coming, and we're going to get reparations. You see, we're going to get it. But see, the whole point is that because we are a people of fighters. I don't want to hear nobody come and tell me about I'm weak. We're not weak. We're not cowards. You see, we're not cowards. We might be foolish. We might be uneducated. We might do some ignorant stuff sometimes, but we're not cowards. And that is very important to remember. But see, they want to got to cow us down. They don't want. They teach you about Nat Turner Rebellion, the other rebellion. But we had 250 rebellions. We've been fighting. Always been fighting. You see, we had the black and white Indian wars, the Tuscarero, you know, the E.T. We had lots of wars with them, the Seminoles, you see, the Yamasee. See, but they just want to make you feel you're a coward so you can just be somebody to be scary. My father taught me to be a man, you see.
Right.
I had five boys, and I tried to teach them to be a man, you see. They take care of their families. Like I told them, I said, I'll always love you. I'll love the death out of you. But you know, I said, I don't want to love you. I want to respect you.
Mm-hmm,
and I said, the only way you can earn my respect is to be a man. Take care of your family. Fight for yourself and be black first. See, I only wanted those three things.
Mm-hmm,
see,
mm-hmm.
but a black man and his children, they had to be respected and respectable. See, he was right about The Moors say this, and the Hebrews say that, and the Pan-Africans say this. Forget all that mess. We foundation of Black America. That's one good
thing.
Right.
See? That's right.
See?
That's right.
When you said tribalistic, you were right. When they say he belongs, and they tell Oprah she's Zulu, and tell somebody else he's Mandy, that's putting you into a damn tribe.
Exactly, and I know he didn't like it, but ain't nothing he could do about it because I'm telling the truth. You see, Dr. Winters, a lot of people, because I have this old Southern bro, they think they're talking to a damn fool. But I'm nobody's fool. I play a fool to catch a fool, but I'm nobody's fool. I can read, write, and articulate. And the bottom line is we don't have time or the resources to invest in genetic testing to close these inequality gaps. To transfer authority to ourselves, we need a homeland internally. Sister Candida and I, we're looking at Oklahoma. We have land in different counties available here in the South where we can relocate to and acquire land and also control it politically. That's where we're trying to go. That's where I'm trying to go. I don't have time to be worried about what they got over there in Africa. Look at Haiti. Haiti went over there and tried to ask to be a part of the African Union, and they denied them that. So if you don't have any respect for Haiti, how can I even begin to fathom looking towards Africa as a homeland?
We have South Africa become free. It was Stevie Wonder who helped spread that movement to disinvest in South Africa. You don't see them doing nothing for us. We have Mozambique, Angola. We were over here promoting them, Pan-Africanism. None of the African nations ever fight for us.
And you're right, Doctor. And you're right. And you're right. And you know what? Let the truth be told. When Stevie Wonder and them was over there singing them Kumbaya songs over there for South Africa, they should have been taking the crime of apartheid to the doorsteps of the UN along with South Africa.
That's right. That's right.
That's what should have happened. They should have been fighting for the. They should have been fight. We should have been fighting for ourselves, and that's the issue.
Yeah.
We always put our nose in everybody else's business, and we don't put and don't sweep around our own front door politically. We're not over here. We're not safe. We did a threat assessment months ago. We've exceeded the threshold for a mass atrocity. I'm just waiting for them to come round us up.
Yeah.
Like
or try.
It can
or
happen
try.
At any time. At any time. And none
at
of these
time.
Organizations are ready. None of them.
And
not even us.
That's,
because we don't
that's
even fathom that this United States would do that to us, but they will. And they are.
That's right.
Yeah,
right.
I like to add to the conversation. I mean, right now, when you get what you just said, they're doing it right now. Everybody's getting ready to put these inoculations in their arms. They don't even know what they're getting inoculated with. So that just goes to tell you a lot of the level of thinking. Just you know, follow what they say. But one of the things I wanted to comment on is something you brought up: slavery. When they talk about slavery, and there was a group of lawyers that tried to sue for reparations. The point that they don't bring up that slavery was illegal. See, the European tries to say that slavery was legal, but when you start talking about law and international law, there was treaties in place that
yep.
said that West Africa couldn't be enslaved because they put them
yep.
under the dominion of the Sultan of Morocco, all of West Africa. And according to law, they said that that was a country or empire that was in enmity with England. So when they started that whole slave trade thing, that was illegal. They were pirateering and kidnapping people.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to bring up is this is one of the biggest things to this day. It's on the books. The U.S. Supreme Court to this day says it's legal. The Christian doctrine of discovery, right? That's what they use to steal all the land, whether you're a Mongoloid, whether you're Aboriginal, to steal the land from the original people in this land, right? They say that the Christian doctrine of discovery gave them the right to come over here and conquer the heathens and take the land in the name of the Pope of Rome or whatever other Christian type of kingdom that was involved with that. But if you read, even if you read the origin of the Christian doctrine of discovery, it didn't apply to any other European country besides the Portuguese and the Spanish, right? And it was only relegated to a certain part, even though it's bullcrap anyway. But for these Europeans over here in the United States to try to camel back off on that and say, well, slavery was legal, is a bunch of bullshit. You know what I mean? So when we're talking about slavery, it's not slavery. It was a war that was going on, right? And it was actually a racial war because Europeans used race to promote slavery. So
remember, most of the royalty of Britain was black. You know, but they had to kill off most of them so they could flip the script.
Yeah, exactly. They killed them off. So when we're talking about slavery, we need to change the conversation to it was a war, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't no slavery. These are prisoners of war, right?
That's right.
Because
that's right.
That whole slavery thing, that was illegal. Pirateering and customary international law, pirateering has always been illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Kidnapping
mm-hmm.
people has always been illegal. Murder has always been illegal.
But see that's, why, ever, that's why everything's on white and I say so. They white and they say so. That's what it's all about. Instead of being real history, instead of being real law. But as Sister Elena said, is that you have to fight. You have to fight on all fronts. You can't just go away. Just like when the brother said that the Mali Empire was engaged in the slave trade. No, they didn't have that much slavery. They didn't have no slavery up there. Mali Empire was keeping it the slaves from being sold. They came to the coast and Portugal made treaties and then they sold the people on the coast because they were, you know, we always been selling each other out. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. There ain't never been no black unity, you see. But we can unify here because see, it wasn't any black unity in Africa because like Sister Elena said, they were tribalistic.
They still are.
That's right. Calling ourselves foundational black Americans, that take away all the tribes now, see?
Mm-hmm.
That take away all the tribes. That's our new nationality. I like the way you put that, Sister Elena. I like the way you put that. I like the way you said that, is that we are one now in terms of, and as opposed to being tribalistic.
But
when you start
see,
trying
Dr.
to say
Winter,
you belong to
they think we crazy. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
In this fight, I've been in this fight, Dr. Winters, and I'm so glad that and I really appreciate your support and your work. And I'm telling you up front what Elena's going to do with your work. I'm walking it up in that inter-American court to help secure our rights. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to consult you first. But I appreciate what you've done, and you may not get the recognition right now, But I can assure you, once it hit the international arena, you're going to get the recognition you deserve. Being in this fight, Dr. Winters, being in this fight, what I've found, we have these elitist Negroes who are masquerading as Pan-Africans, as Black nationalists, when they are gatekeeping. And it comes through the spirit, and it comes through their tone. See, it's just like this. Our grassroots population, they're politically and legally illiterate. Even the leadership is politically and legally illiterate. They don't know we got a whole nother layer of rights that we don't even scratch the surface on. And as a result, we're still in the economic situation that we're in because we have not went in for control. I'm sorry, but I don't want my grandchildren to be competing with expat Africans, Mexicans, or anybody. I want them to have their own place that they administer, that they govern. That's what we should want for our children, not to go into the next decade as somebody's liquid money or liquid market. These Indians come over here, they get fat like frogs, and they can transfer generational wealth because they have a guaranteed spot at your local convenience store. Miss Lean transfers a whole lot of wealth. That's why I don't know where they became victims at, because they get all of our money. Every single month they get our money. So how in the hell are we mistreating them? Okay? We got to go in for control. You see what I'm saying? And when I say control, that means we got to control our politics, our economy, our identity from the root to the fruit. We can't be half-stepping here. And genetics on the face is shaky and can be weaponized against us. I didn't misconstrue that when I spoke to that brother. I stood on that, and I'm standing on it now. Now, I was born at night, but I wasn't born last night. Anytime you can set up anything or transfer any type of genetics, you can transfer that genetics from one place to the other and mess up the whole specimen. So if we can do that in criminology, how can that not happen when you're dealing with ancestry? Come on now.
That's right.
I was born at night, but it wasn't last night.
I'd like to add something on that as well in regards to genetics. Two things. I think if anything, you should copyright or try to get a patent, something that is going to preserve your genetic identity. Because what people don't realize with most of these ancestry companies, once you submit your specimen to them, they own the rights to your genetic identification. You see what I'm saying? And that's how they come up with different medicines. And one of the things I thought about this probably about 20 years ago, people don't understand what an ethnic bomb is or a bio bomb, where if they have a database where they could isolate your specific genetics, they could come up with an algorithm or biological weapon to try to destroy your whole biology and your whole family, your whole group, your whole ethnicity. I had a book before that documented some of this, and it was some of the research in that area was done in the illegal state of Israel. So when we're talking about DNA and doing these ancestry tests, it's very dangerous because you're giving up rights to your genetic identity, right? Mm-hmm. And then they're being sold to pharmaceutical industries. They're being sold to the police. They're being sold to everywhere, and you're not benefiting from that. So you paid money to get a test done, and they're taking your information and selling it and making more money than you paid for. You understand? So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is this. When the brother Sifuway was on earlier, he was saying that he was he's connected to that specific tribe. But I find it hard to understand how you could just say to that specific tribe when there's been mixing going on. Unless your family was interbred for the past couple hundred years and you're only intermarried with your relatives who came directly from that tribe on the ship, I don't see how you wouldn't be related to any other tribe. You know what I mean? So I don't understand that aspect of it as well.
You ever see? Yeah. Remember, why didn't I say so? The white man said Rick Kettles is the truth. Rick Kettles is just a, he just working for the white man to keep a nigga down. I'm sorry. See, I'm sorry. You know, he can have the nerve to tell me, my mama told me, I'm part Choctaw. You don't tell me I'm not. Get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, too, you know, here in the South, we have a very rich culture because we're a timeless people. I mean, we've been everything.
That's right.
And as a matter of fact, here in the United States now, I don't know, a lot of people thought Dr. York was crazy. He wasn't crazy, you know, because he went through different periods of identity, calling themselves different, you know, different periods of identity and explaining the political issues that came with that identity. We are a timeless people because we've been here, and we just can't throw all of that away, and we just can't base that all of that on shaky science. And to me, that's what genetics is. It's shaky. It's not concrete. It's shaky. It could be manipulated. It could be weaponized. So why would I put us in a position at this time? You know, this is from my perspective. And from where I'm coming from, based on my research, what I, Elena, has done, why would I put us in a position that could take us 50 years back when we on life support right now? We got to move right now if we're going to close these wealth gaps. If we want to stop police brutality, it's not begging these people to quit killing us. No, we get them out of our areas where we, the majority of the population, put our own administration in, whether it's a county or a state, and we could move on. That's how you do that.
Yep.
That's how other colonized people work. Now, I don't know where these other people are getting their strategies from, but I just don't see me and my family spending no $300 a piece doing no DNA test to connect me back to a failed state, because on life support right now. It's unorganized, and it's politically unfit for even Africans to be there. Look, they fight desert sand, everything to get out from over there. Why? Because of their poor leadership. All of their resources are being usurped by the Indians, by the Chinese, by the Americans, by the British, and by the French. That place has been recolonized over and over again, so why would we tie ourselves to that? They don't want to.
Yeah.
When I have been on the phone with different Africans, they will say, "Oh, well, you don't need to tie yourself to this movement. Speak to somebody in Cabinda, or well, you know, you all have a different fight." That's because they think they're going to eat the crumbs off that white man's table. We got to know who we're dealing with. You speak
That's
to some
right.
South Africans. Oh, well, we don't want you to tie yourself to this. Well, what do you want to do for us? Well, if you don't want to do nothing, get the hell out of our business. Don't come over here in our neighborhoods, and we're going to put a partition up against, a partition between us. You expat, you better secure your shit over there. But we need to secure what's here, okay, for our children.
They come over here cowardly and stuff. We fight. We're fighters. Get out.
That's right.
We fight here.
That's right. That's right. So we've got to do, you know, we've got to do what we got to do and set the record straight. If there's any other callers before we end the call, would you like to say something to Brother Issa or Dr. Winters? Sister Lily, are you still on? And with that being said, I'm going to yield the floor to you, Dr. Winters, to close us out, and Brother Issa, after Dr. Winters, if you have some last words you'd like to share.
No, I think Dr. Winters should close it out. He's the elder, and I respect his scholarship and everything. I like to let him close it out. Peace.
The last word that I'd like to say is this, is that we do have an identity. We have oral tradition. We don't have to wait for the white man to give us no car. We don't have to wait for no DNA test to tell us that we are indigenous. We already knew that, you see. We ran away from it because we was ashamed. I was ashamed. I was ashamed for most of my life to be Choctaw because it looked like we were losers, you see. During the 60s, during the 70s, I was fighting for this and fighting for that, and we failed. Because I was for real, for real. When I wore an Afro, I wore it for real. Some people weren't. But today, luckily, I'm hoping that Biden is going to show these people who voted for him, like the people who voted for Trump, that they don't mean you no good and that we have to fight to get our rights and that we are a people with a vote. We are people with an identity, and we're not lost.
That's true. That's true. Well, Dr. Winters, I certainly do appreciate all that you do. I certainly appreciate your work. Do you have a website where you can plug your books and your research material?
All I had to do is go to Amazon.com, put in Clive Winters, Amazon.com, and they'll show all 30 books I wrote. But the thing is that it's all about fighting. It's all about the truth. And the thing is that we have to just maintain the truth. We need people like you, Alana. We need people who are going to stand up and fight. And it's good that you bring people on to try to talk about these things because, see, the fact is that we can't go backwards. We can't let using DNA, you're letting a white man identify you because these black people, Rick Kettles and the rest of them, they're not for you. They're about money. Bill Gates about money. They're about being with their you know, their white friends and white family. I have nothing against it. I got white people who I consider to maybe be a friend, maybe. But they ain't never been put to the test. But the thing is that we got to love ourselves and love our children and want to have something for them and our grandchildren.
That's right.
We got to
want
to have something for them.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, Dr. Winters, thank you so much for your time on this beautiful Sunday. Thank you for all you do. You know you're always a part of the Sister Awareness Radio Show, and don't be a stranger, and you have a wonderful rest of your night.
Thank you. And you guys have a great one, too. Bye-bye.